You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
So it is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Sean Westmoreland. Westmoreland is a former Air Force technician. He served in Kandahar Airfield, Afghanistan, at the 73rd Expeditionary Air Control Squadron. He assisted in building a signal relay station that was used for transmitting and receiving data, radio picture for unmanned, that is, drones and manned missions for approximately 250,000 square miles over Afghanistan. He is no longer in the military and is a member of Veterans for Peace and Iraq Veterans Against the War. Sean Westmoreland, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for speaking about this. I imagine it can be difficult at times. I wonder if we could start just briefly with how you got into the military in the first place.
Well, my father was in the Air Force. He's a Russian linguist, and we traveled around quite a lot. Essentially, my whole life has been surrounded by the military. And I guess when I was 17, my parents got a divorce because my father came out as being gay, and I was really raised religious my whole life. So I guess I was kind of looking for a sort of stability in my life, and I also wanted to serve my country. I was very affected by 9/11. And I was dating somebody at the time who tried to kill herself. So I kind of I was looking to escape, and I was looking to do something meaningful with my life. I didn't really have too many options in the town that I grew up in.
I've seen some interviews and statements you've made, and applaud you for speaking out about drones together with three other former members of the military, Brandon Bryant, Michael Haas, and Stephen Lewis. You together sent a letter to President Obama and Secretary of so-called Defense Carter and CIA Director Brennan. I saw that you said that your rethinking of what you were doing in Afghanistan and thinking about what you might be doing to innocent victims was sort of begun when a mortar strike landed near you, which seems in need of explanation. A threat to yourself resulted in your thinking about the threat being caused to others. How did that happen?
I mean, we landed in Afghanistan. It was right during a mortar attack, and we heard bombs outside the plane. So that was my first introduction to Kandahar. The next few weeks, there was quite a few mortar strikes after that, and my site was in a sort of barren part of the base right next to a double chain-link fence, and that was really all that was protecting us from the outside. Every day, you would see a shepherd and his kids take their flock nearby the fence because that's where the water ran. The kids would, stand there for a while and watch us, and they would beg for water or candy or something. And I'd always want to give it to them. I've got a big heart, I guess. And my commander told us not to, and I guess that's for our own safety. I mean, they have the tactics that are employed by the Taliban or whatever group is angry at us at that time, that we sort of blanket under the Taliban. I would look at them and I would just think, every day, I'm watching them and they're begging for water, and here behind me is a McDonald's and, a Tim Hortons and, all these luxuries of home, and it's kind of ridiculous, but it's also, I know it's used for R&R for the people that are out in the field, but at the same time, it's also just sort of, insulting. I don't know if that's the right word, but yeah, so we had several mortar attacks, and once when I was on guard duty for the compound. I had a morgue land about 100 feet away from me. I started having nightmares about the mortars' attacks and being attacked and just, you know, threat to my own life. And I know other people in the tent were as well. Like, you would hear people randomly in the middle of the night roll over off their tots onto the ground. I guess I started thinking, you know, here I am in the military, and I'm kind of scared for my life at points. And I'm looking at these kids, and this is their everyday reality, and this is what they're having to go through. And I started thinking about, you know, what people's lives, how they're affected out there in the villages, and, you know, these places that we're bombing. I mean, I spent about 3 years of my childhood in a country called Armenia. It was right after the fall of the Soviet Union, about 1997. There's people freezing out there in the, you know, in the countryside, and, you know, they don't have gas lines out there. They can't afford wood, and people are starving, and, you know, and I've seen these conditions, and they're very similar to what the conditions were of the people in Afghanistan. Maybe were quite possibly worse, way worse than in Armenia. But I'm thinking about these daily issues that these people have to deal with. And in addition to being, you know, under constant coercion of either the coalition militaries or the Taliban, so to speak. And a couple of weeks later, after the mortar hit, my boss pulled us around the equipment that we set up there, and he handed us a headset, and he said, he handed us to listen, and A-10 speaking to a battle manager, and he smiled, and he said, "We're killing bad guys now, boys." And I knew enough about airstrikes. I knew from what my father spoke about being in the headquarters in Kuwait during the initial bombing of Afghanistan, that people making decisions aren't, you know, always really considering the people on the ground. They're really just looking for, you know, notches to put under their belt so they can get awards and decorations.
In fact, you've said that your father said that anyone wearing white was presumed Taliban and justified as a target. Is that right?
In the early days of Afghanistan, yes. I'm sure that's changed. But I guess that kind of is reflective of the military mentality. You know, it's our leadership isn't quite the same as the leadership we had in World War II, per se. It's more or less a for-profit venture. When you get out of the military, you expect to get a job in the defense sector, an executive position. And really, like, it's about racking up as many awards and decorations as you possibly can. There's a lot of competition. And I think that kind of is a conflict of interest from, you know, actually fixing the situation. Because if they're offered future prospects of a high-paying position on the outside of the military, then they have an incentive to keep wars going and keep the conflict there. And I don't necessarily agree with that. I was offered a position with a few defense contractors after I got out, and I refused. And, you know, I was offered a reenlistment bonus, and I didn't take it. But you know, a lot of people do, and a lot of you know, officers do.
You were offered quite well-paying jobs and chose to get out. And you were, you know, your colleague in this mission of speaking out now, Brandon Bryant, has famously said in many interviews that he was given a piece of paper crediting him with being part of, I think it was over 1,600 kills. And you've said that you were credited with over 200, being part of missions with over 200 enemy kills. But I imagine there was no detail there in terms of how the so-called enemies were identified. And you later, you've said, saw in a United Nations report for 2009 that there were some 359 civilians killed by airstrikes that they had identified. So you weren't quite given the full story, I imagine.
No, and most people aren't. With Brandon, that was the number his unit, that was credited for. He's credited with 13.
13 or 1,300?
Well, it was 13 kills that he actually pushed the button on.
I see.
And the larger number is what the unit did, but these were missions that he was part of.
And you didn't push a button on any. You were not the so-called pilot, right?
No, he was a sensor operator, so he guided the missile in, and I was a technician to build the infrastructure for this to take place. And I guess my perspective of it is that here was this system that we built, and it was a point of failure. If the system went down, people on the American side might die, especially if it's like a troops in contact situation. And if it was up, then people on the other side would die. So the Afghan. If you could see that, that link there, and understand that, your daily activities in making the system work and building the system is actually, allowing for all these people to engage, with people on the ground. Then I just started to develop a new kind of understanding of what modern warfare actually is. We're moving towards a more network centric warfare. So, orders, spells out over a network and, making systems more, autonomous, putting less humans in the chain. And, a lot of the positions are going to be maintenance. They're going to be their technician jobs to keep these systems up and running. So what is warfare going to turn into when you have situations like that, when you have autonomous, robots either on the ground or in the air making kill decisions? And kind of back to what you were saying, my unit was credited with 200 plus enemy kills, and we got that in our performance reports and on our meritorious unit award. And my achievement medal. So it was kind of something to wrap my head around. When I found that out, I was always resistant to the idea of killing, and I convinced myself otherwise, just to get the job done, because there's also this feeling that I need to be supportive of my unit, and I signed the line, so I bought that whole thing. It's like you signed the line, you swore an oath, you do your job. So I never really questioned that publicly. And I did my job, and now I have to live with that.
But you tell yourself while you're doing it that you're saving U.S. lives and you're supporting your unit and you're fulfilling your promise and your oath, and you don't stop and question every moment, what if this war weren't happening at all? Then I wouldn't have to be here choosing between right. U.S. and Afghan lives. I was very interested in a comment you made that you wrote about, that you were in a college course, and you were shown, you and your classmates were shown the collateral murder video of killing from the air in Iraq that was released by WikiLeaks, and you as a former member of the U.S. military were sort of looked to as having some expertise, and the professor asked you, and you said, and I took it that you thought he expected you to immediately completely denounce the actions in the video as criminal, and instead you said, it was the heat of the moment. Those guys probably hadn't slept. The video feeds are grainy. You can't tell if they're holding weapons or something else. They could be insurgents. They could be anyone. I would have made the same mistake. That may not be what the professor was expecting, and I think it's not what I would be expecting. Is that your view of the situation? Those pilots were in and others are in once they're in warfare. It's just too difficult to make decisions against killing.
Well, you have to kind of look at the background of what a U.S. military person goes through. They go through basic training, and essentially they're coerced into, following this chain of commands that you wouldn't otherwise as a civilian, and you do so out of fear. So in a sense, a lot of people in the military fear their leaders more than they do the enemy. And there's also, quite a bit of like linguistic distortion of reality in situations of war. You use words that dehumanize you from the enemy so that you don't have to confront the fact that you're killing people. And there's also, I don't know if you've ever like read the Milgram experiments.
Sure.
And there's a part where it talks about how when they were trying to find out the resistance of a person to administering these lethal shocks, so to speak, which weren't actually lethal, it was acted, but they found that when a person is behind the window, they're more likely to follow through with orders from positions of authority, and when they're face to face, the likelihood of that happening is much lower. So even a window could be a sort of a barrier to our humanity in situations, and I guess what that. Well, when you consider that when you're looking at imagery on the ground and you're looking through these grainy feeds, you're told that there was gunfighting in the area before this incident occurred, and most of the people in areas of gunfighting. I mean, a lot of the civilians leave, but in this case they were all civilians, and they were reporters in an area where there had just been a gun battle. So they probably weren't even looking for cameras, and they were just looking for things that they could identify as possible weapons. And a lot of these pilots and people in the military are sleep deprived, you know, because you're getting shelled in the night, and you know, and you're also probably dealing with some PTSD at the time, you know, because of traumatic experiences that you've experienced, and nightmares, things like that. I'm not saying this is across the board or that these people even had it. I'm just trying to offer a possible explanation. But
sure.
I think when you're put in these situations of war, you're not really operating under the same moral guidelines as you would if you're in peace times. You're forced to sort of resort, like, to your more primitive brain, I guess you would say, the fight or flight responses, and it's not a justification for what they did. There is no justification for what they did, but I can see how that happened. That's essentially what I was saying.
Yeah.
And I guess I was disturbed in that classroom that I didn't think of the Geneva Convention. First off.
You know, the class discussion was about the Geneva Convention. Why didn't they just follow the rules? And yet, as far as I know, there's never been a war that followed the Geneva Conventions. There's no real empirical way to test whether an action does follow the Geneva Conventions in most cases. And the criticisms the description you're offering of what it's like to participate in a war suggests that it's very unlikely that you're going to be able to create a civilized, rule-following war. In addition, some of the criticisms we've heard about the drone wars suggest that the drones in particular are a problem and we should have wars without them. But here you're talking about manned pilots in the collateral murder video. Is there some way to clean up and civilize war, or is the problem the institution of war itself?
I think our country is very quick to go to war, and it's been very quick since 9/11. We've had a very reactive, presence around the world as a result of 9/11. So this global war on terror, I personally feel that it's a way to get into countries we wouldn't have otherwise gotten into. I believe Wesley Clark was talking about how he heard in the Pentagon that they were going to attack 7 countries in 7 years.
Yep.
And the neoconservative groups within Washington believe that we need to establish a unipolar world, a one like a Pax Americana, take Russia down and China down, a notch, take them down to a, you know, so that they're not a superpower, so that we can have coercive influence over them as well. In international relations theory, you actually find that, several scholars believe that, a unipolar world is one of the most unstable, geopolitical structures out there, because when you have a single power that is exerting influence on the entire world, then people bandwagon against that influence. And I think neoconservatism, there's people who are neoconservatives that are probably coming from, a place of, wanting to establish a more long-term peace. But I don't think doing so through, the barrel of a gun is a way to achieve that peace. It's a way to subjugate other other groups of people.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be working. There seems to be a growth in recruitment for anti-American organizations as a direct result of the fighting that is supposed to eliminate those organizations. And I mean, I've been collecting statements from people who point out the counterproductive nature of what the U.S. military is doing on its own terms, including former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Michael Flynn, former director of National Intelligence, Dennis Blair, former deputy director of CIA, Michael Morrell, former CIA bin Laden unit chief, Michael Schur, and dozens more. And it's always former. It's always someone who's left the military. No one in the military says what we're doing is counterproductive. But do they know it? Do they know? Do people at high levels in the U.S. military know that what they're doing is counterproductive, or do they believe they're going to eliminate terror?
I can't really answer that question because I know Stanley McChrystal came out and he spoke against the drone warfare.
Yeah, create 10 for every innocent you kill, he said.
Yeah, he was my commander at the time in Afghanistan. Back to drones. Drones are kind of a political tool to maintain a sustained coercive influence on these countries. There isn't people dying as a result of it. I mean, not through direct conflict, so it's less of a you don't have to win the hearts and minds of the public to do it. And in order to sort of push forward this global military presence or full-spectrum dominance is kind of the military lingo for what they're wanting to do, then you need to have weapons that don't really have the issue of, having dying or, getting captured or whatnot. As far as the drones go, I don't think that they're a great tool. I don't think warfare in general should be used as a first measure by any means. I mean, we're the most powerful country in the world. We can find ways to find peace diplomatically. But, I mean, the number of diplomats we have in the world is about as many personnel as we have in two Nimitz-class aircraft carriers. I don't think it's proportional, and I don't think we really focus so much on diplomacy, but diplomacy is used used in conjunction with military action.
I'm afraid, going to have to continue this conversation in a future interview. There are a million topics I would love to have gotten to. Sean Westmoreland is working on incredible projects that we haven't even touched on. Go to projectredhand.org to learn more. Sean, thank you so much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
No problem. Love for you to have me back.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersmith.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Barack Obama described beheadings by the extremist group ISIS as an assault on all humanity. But when U.S. ally Saudi Arabia executed 47 people on January 2nd, many by beheading, the administration expressed concern and urged restraint. Media don't make it easy to make sense of U.S. policy in the Gulf region. We'll get some context from Toby Craig Jones, associate professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. Also on the show, for U.S. media, Haiti is just, as CBS News put it recently, a shamble made worse by a corrupt government. You'd hardly guess what role the international community, and in particular the U.S., have had in creating the country's current situation, including the confusion and mistrust about the ongoing presidential election. We'll hear from Jake Johnston on that. He's a research associate at the Center for Economic and Policy Research and lead author for the center's Haiti Relief and Reconstruction Watch. All of that's coming up, but first, a quick look back at recent press. Whatever one may think about the armed anti-government militias who occupied a federal building in Oregon on January 2nd, it's hard to deny that they benefited, especially initially, from a different media approach than other groups would almost certainly receive. The Malheur National Wildlife Refuge was not occupied when Eamon and Ryan Bundy and their cohorts moved in, but the group made it clear they were willing to use violence and they hoped to inspire a larger anti-government uprising. They're the sons of right-wing extremist Cliven Bundy, who led a similar standoff in 2014 in which armed militias occupied federal land, pointed guns at law enforcement, and got fairly gracious media coverage until he started talking about things he knew about the Negro. Nevertheless, as Ben Norton noted for Fair.org, media reports like that from the Associated Press spoke of a peaceful protest. Not just not making clear that the militants were armed, but implying that they were not, telling readers that, quote, some local residents feared that the Saturday rally would involve more than speeches, flags, and marching. But the only real additions to that list seemed to be songs, flowers, and pennies, close quote. Protesters evidently threw pennies at courthouse doors to signify civilians buying back their government. It doesn't imply a call for a violent police crackdown in Oregon to simply acknowledge that this treatment differs meaningfully from coverage of, for example, Black Lives Matter activists, who are often portrayed by media as dangerous even when they are peaceful, and whose movement has led media to leap on sketchy claims like that of an anarchist plot to ambush cops on Halloween, or a teen purge designed to terrorize citizens of Baltimore, or a baseless claim of increased crime as a result. Nor does it seem too much to suggest that laughing it off might not be the most appropriate response to armed people organized around a far-right ideology who are successfully using threats of violence to advance their political agenda. The Washington Post's Catherine Rampell used a December 24th column to dismiss as benighted college students protesting racism and sexism on campus. If students want to feel like victims, Rampell advised, there are very real underappreciated ways they're being economically victimized. What are the things those silly kids really ought to be upset about? Well, the headline tips you off. College students should aim their rage at older Americans, not administrators. Yes, it's still another iteration of what Dean Baker called a popular Washington pastime, trying to get young people angry at their parents and grandparents so that they're not bothered by the enormous upward redistribution of income taking place in the country. Rampell says, quote, our politicians are paying off older, higher voter turnout Americans in the form of generous benefits that those older people have not paid for and never will, which means the tab will need to be picked up by someone else, i.e. someone younger, close quote. She points to Medicare as paying out much more than is paid in taxes, saying that's just one way spending on the old is crowding out spending on the young. Well, you probably get the idea because you've probably heard it before, but repetition doesn't add to the argument's truthfulness. As Baker explains, and you can find the full piece on fair.org, most of the reason the value of Medicare benefits exceeds the value of the taxes paid is not the generosity of the benefits received by our seniors. The main cause is the fact that we pay our doctors twice as much as doctors in Canada, Germany, and other wealthy countries. We also pay twice as much for our drugs and medical equipment. This is a case of upward redistribution from the rest of us to members of the 1%. But rather than talking about how the rich raise the cost of our health care, Rampell wants us to be upset at seniors. This is not to mention that Social Security also provides survivor and disability benefits that often help the young. Or to ask how cutting benefits for many older people or people with disabilities who live with their children or grandchildren would help anyone. Rampell's rhetoric misses the bigger picture that the tax burdens associated with government debt or Social Security are a relatively small part of the overall economy that will be passed on to the younger generation. What, for example, of the generational inequity presumed by forcing children to grow up with parents who are unemployed or living in poverty because the debt-obsessed, beltway-minded won't let us spend the money to employ them or let them have decently paid jobs? Well, finally, Rampell's invocation of the boogeymen, political correctness, entitlements, and old people, oh my, is standard fare for the Washington Post. That worldview will be even less contested now that the paper has decided to end its contract with Harold Meyerson, a progressive reporter whose weekly pieces have run in the paper for the last 13 years. Meyerson wrote often about labor and government policy that benefited the haves over the have-nots. He's still editor-at-large of the American Prospect and writes for the L.A. Times, but evidently Washington Post opinion page editor Fred Hyatt told Meyerson his columns had bad social media metrics and focused too much on issues like worker power. So, readers looking for alternative visions to that of Rampell's, of greedy old people sucking up benefits as an appropriate source of public rage, will have even less reason to pick up the paper. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Saudi Arabia executed 47 people on January 2nd, including a high-profile cleric, Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, who, while a leader from the Shia community, called for solidarity among the oppressed against their oppressors, regardless of sect or nationality. The executions were largely beheadings, and it was not lost on some observers that this brutal technique is a hallmark of ISIS, the reviled extremist group whose horrors are reported and denounced routinely in the U.S. media, while Saudi Arabia is a U.S. ally and rarely subject to that sort of scrutiny. Public executions are not just killings, of course. They're meant to convey a message. So what is the Saudi leadership saying, if you will, and what does it or might it mean for the U.S.-Saudi alliance and for our understanding of U.S. foreign policy? Joining us now to provide some context is Toby Craig Jones, Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University and author of, among other titles, Desert Kingdom: How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. His op-ed, Saudi Arabia's Dangerous Sectarian Game, appeared in the January 4th New York Times. Welcome to Counterspin, Toby Jones.
It's good to be with you.
Well, these were far from the first public executions carried out by the Saudi monarchy. I understand they are on the rise, though, 158 people executed in 2015. Clearly, it's not simple, but help us understand some of the context for these actions within Saudi Arabia itself.
The message very broadly was that terrorism will not be tolerated in the kingdom, a kind of clear message that dissent or any other kind of challenge to the political order in the kingdom was going to be punished with the most extreme measures possible. The killing of al-Nimr could be read in a couple of ways. It can be read domestically as a palliative against the Sunni base, if you will, that might have looked at the execution of Sunni extremists as something questionable and needed a bit of amelioration, if you will. But I think there was another message here as well, and that was that the Saudis were sending a signal to its own Shiite community, as well as across the region, that sectarianism, Iranian meddling or influence, and the perception of a Shiite menace more broadly is also something that's equally dangerous in their view.
Well, the U.S. response has been restrained, shall we say, expressions of concern, urgings of caution, and that's certainly better than ignoring it. But Obama called the ISIS beheadings an assault on all humanity. I'm not trying to play over ingenuous here, but if the U.S. goal is anti-terrorism or regional stability, how do we make sense of the fealty to Saudi Arabia? I mean, is there no conflict there? How do we understand what the U.S. is sort of standing for with its alliance with Saudi Arabia?
Well, the U.S. isn't standing for anything. I mean, I think that we need to set aside, with a great deal of cynicism, any claim to principle on the part of Obama, any of his predecessors, or any of his likely successors. They're all interested in maintaining a relationship with Saudi Arabia for a very narrow range of purposes. So none of this is troubling from the perspective of American power, even if Obama thinks about it and laments what's at stake. There's not much he can do about it. So the reason that I think the U.S. has been mostly silent, in fact, it's worse than silent, the U.S. largely supports Saudi Arabia no matter what it does, it boils down to a kind of old approach to thinking about strategic interests in the region, whether it's oil or the regional balance of power. But it's also important to note, and I think this often goes observed but isn't carefully appreciated, is that Saudi Arabia recycles a tremendous amount of its oil revenues into the U.S. economy, particularly through the purchase of weapons. The U.S. just concluded a $1.2 billion weapons sale with Saudi Arabia. That's a large amount of money to go into the pockets of our gun makers, into the Pentagon.
Well, we often are accused of being sort of reductionist or cynical when we talk about oil or arms, though I know that William Hartung has talked about the billions of arms deals with Saudi Arabia just recently and, in fact, noted that General Dynamics is keeping a whole tank line open through sales to Saudi Arabia. But in the U.S. media, it's often reduced to this kind of, you know, almost tribal religious enmity. You know, CBS, for example, said that al-Nimr's killing inflamed a 1,400-year-old conflict between Sunni and Shiite Muslims. It's possible to overemphasize this religious enmity, don't you think? It sort of depoliticizes what might be going on.
Oh, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, I couldn't agree more. There are a couple of things that play well, and whether it's a result of the naivete of the typical American media consumer or of the media itself, kind of thinking of ways to access and tell stories that they're not very familiar with, there are a couple of tropes. One is the myth of ancient hatreds. And think about the scale of this in the Middle East. It's not only Shia and Sunni, it's Muslim and Jew. I mean, it's persistent and it's everywhere you look. I mean, it's wrong, of course. I mean, and as a historian, it's easy to get frustrated. But it's also the case that there's a second trope, and I think this one has been evident as well, and it resists careful media analysis. That following 1979, and especially the revolution in Iran and the rise of Iran, widely perceived as a kind of regional menace, but also as a danger to American interests. And it plays very well for American audiences to see Iran as always guilty of some kind of conspiratorial maneuvering, of hostility. Iranian perfidy is easy to consume. along with these claims of ancient hatreds. I think those are tropes that are mostly lazy. They're not careful. And the frustrating part of all of this from the perspective of a scholar is that since 2003, a lot of people have collectively been pushing back against it, and yet it continues to enjoy a foothold in how the region is covered.
We hear a lot about this idea of radicalization, you know, and the image that we get is kind of a ragtag group in the desert or disaffected loners in the U.S. joining online chat groups. Is it not fair to characterize Saudi Arabia as supporting or perhaps even exporting this extremism in the way that we ostensibly are so worried about? Where does this idea of radicalization fit in, do you think?
I think this is complicated ground, yeah. and I agree that precisely this issue should be explored further. What is Saudi Arabia's role in the operations of ISIS or al-Qaeda or other quote-unquote radical networks across the region? I think where Saudi Arabia has the greatest amount of clarity in its policy on terrorism is at home. Any threat inside the kingdom is taken very seriously and is viewed with a great deal of alarm. And we might see that the Saudis behave in a way that's consistent with their denunciations of terrorism. But it's in places like Yemen and Syria and Iraq, where they support al-Qaeda on the ground. They claim to be speaking out or challenging ISIS, and yet they don't seem to do very much about it. That's a problem. Mm-hmm. And there, their interests get muddy, and it runs up against other things, like how to deal with Iran. So I think the official state policy of Saudi Arabia is not to support terrorism. But then what happens on the ground raises real questions about whether they're serious about it. And if so, what are they doing to combat it? And I think the answer is not very much.
Well, the Washington Post's David Ignatius closed his recent column by saying, "The Saudis need reassurance that Washington has their back." As media consumers, we conflate the people of a country with its leadership. There's very little understanding of what the people might actually want. But what do you make of this idea that what the Saudis most need is Washington to have their back as the media message to the U.S. population?
I have a lot of thoughts about Ignatius's claim, not all of which are fit for expression here. It's an absurd claim. It's an absurd claim for lots of reasons. It assumes that the United States itself is a stabilizing force in the Middle East. And anybody who's even paid half attention over the last 30 years to American activism and adventurism in the Middle East would come to the exact opposite conclusion. But it's also the case that there are real limits to American power. Let's assume that the U.S. could actually be a force for good. It's not as though the Saudis would take criticism well and would then all of a sudden change their behavior. I think what's needed, rather than a pat on the back and reassurance, is a new kind of political relationship in which the United States neither enables nor tolerates the kind of destabilizing behavior that the Saudis have engaged in, and rather says, look, there will be consequences to this, and the consequences could be an end to arms sales, a withdrawal of the U.S. military, which I think is necessary, but all kinds of other regular, normal political measures that any other state on the planet might expect to have to deal with if they behave the way the Saudis do. The Saudis don't need a special relationship with the U.S. They need a normal relationship with the U.S.
We've been speaking with Toby Craig Jones of Rutgers University. His most recent book is Running Dry, Essays on Energy, Water, and Environmental Crisis. Thank you very much, Toby Craig Jones, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
It was great to be with you. Thank you.
There is an electoral crisis in Haiti, a New York Times editorial declared just last month. The October election to determine who will succeed President Michel Martelly was marked with reports of abuse, including ballot tampering and illegal voting. But on January 5th, the New York Times ran just a short AP piece saying that an investigative committee has determined that even though just 8% of tally sheets and other documents were free from irregularities, that's not evidence of fraud, just incompetence. U.S. media don't talk a great deal about Haiti, but that doesn't mean that the United States is not deeply involved in the politics of the country. Jake Johnston is research associate at the Center for Economic and Policy Research and lead author for the center's Haiti Relief and Reconstruction Watch. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jake Johnston.
Thanks for having me.
Well, my sense is that you can't really sort out what's happening in this election process in Haiti without going back at least as far as the election of 2010. What happened then, and what does it have to do with what's happening now?
That was the first election that was held after the devastating earthquake that hit Haiti in 2010. And despite the sort of logistical problems, you know, 1.5 million displaced, a cholera epidemic, et cetera, they pushed forward with this election. Not surprisingly, there was a significant amount of problems with it, including about 15% of the vote simply never was counted. Instead of doing a proper investigation, the U.S. pressured the Haitian government through revocation of visas, through threatening to cut off aid, et cetera, and forced the Organization of American States mission went to Haiti and overturned the results of the election without conducting any recount. This removed the government's candidate from the race and put Michel Martelly into that second round and eventually the presidency. And this sort of set his term off on such a wrong foot and with such a lack of legitimacy in the eyes of many Haitians, because this was seen as a solution imposed from the outside. And fast forward 5 years, we've got Michel Martelly's handpicked successor running an election. And in fact, according to the official results, the second place candidate is Jude Celestin, the man the U.S. kicked out of the race in 2010. And that sort of sets the stage for the crisis that's currently happening.
So it's interesting then that the Washington Post in December 2015 editorialized that even though the first round of elections in October was marked by fraud, a recount was not the answer. And, quote, a better way out of the impasse is to proceed with the runoff with guarantees of enhanced scrutiny by international election observers from the Organization of American States and elsewhere. You can see why many Haitians and others would think that's not the right response.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, we've been discussing sort of the presidential election, and certainly that's what's received the most attention. But alongside this are also legislative elections, local elections. And there haven't been any elections whatsoever and since that flawed one in 2010. That has meant the president's been left to rule the country without a parliament as a check on him, and local officials have been replaced by political appointees. So we're in a situation right now that is not sort of a well-functioning democracy. Now, with this current election, and you can see, you know, as you mentioned with the OAS, their sort of credibility within Haiti after their role in 2010 has been shot, and it was sort of reinforced after parliamentary elections in August, where 25% of the votes never made it to be count, armed gangs shut down the vote. It was a real mess. And yet the OAS came out and said, well, it was good enough to move on. And again, they did the same thing after the October presidential elections, in which a number of local observer groups documented widespread irregularities. And this contrasted so much with what the international observers were saying.
U.S. corporate media tend to write about Haiti in terms that, again, the Washington Post, they refer to Haiti's chronic instability, which rivals its profound poverty as a source of suffering. There's kind of a tone of those Haitians, why can't they get themselves together? You don't really hear a lot about the role of the United States and other international actors creating the current situation in Haiti. The group Other Worlds Are Possible is producing a series of interviews on land rights and food sovereignty in Haiti that's highlighting what essentially is corporate pillaging or the redirection of resources from collective to private property. And I know that you've done some investigation on what happens to those aid dollars, billions of dollars that we're told are being sent to Haiti. Where is it going? Who is it helping? What's happened with that money?
And when you look at the billions that have been spent in Haiti after the earthquake, you know, it's easy to sort of blame the Haitians, right? They've squandered this money, that nothing works. But if you take a deeper look, you realize that most of this money never actually made it to Haiti or to Haitians. You know, this money goes right back to donor governments' home countries, either in the form of contracts to for-profit companies, to grants to NGOs, or to multilateral bodies which have their own development agendas. And so the very little money is actually going through the Haitian government or through Haitian companies. The rationale is that, well, these institutions, these companies are not accountable, the money will go to corruption, etc. But if you take a sort of different perspective and look at sort of just the efficiency of aid, you know, when you look at how much money comes off the top in overhead or how much money just is sent back to headquarters of companies rather than actually spent on the ground, you know, losing some money to corruption is probably a much more efficient way to spend money than simply giving it to for-profit contractors in a different country.
Well, as you've reported on this, and I know you've been to Haiti many times and tried to report on how that money is functioning, but there are impediments to actually getting that story. I understand that the money that comes from USAID, when you try to investigate where it goes, you run up against some real material hardships in even getting the information.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I think this has been, a fight that many have been waging for years with opening up this black box and getting greater transparency on how U.S. foreign assistance funds are spent on the ground. And what we can see is a sort of first layer of transparency. For instance, who that money, either a corporation, an NGO, et cetera, receives it at that first level, and then how they actually spend the money is sort of the great mystery. As we know, a significant portion is funneled through subcontracts and then sub-subcontracts, et cetera, and that becomes extremely difficult to trace the money from its origination in the U.S. to anything actually on the ground in Haiti.
Well, what would you say folks should be paying attention to? I mean, we're not getting a lot from U.S. media. What should our questions be as we go forward? I mean, folks think elections are a sign of democracy, so we should be in favor of elections. But if we were interested in really furthering the interests of the Haitian people, what sort of measures would we be talking about right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think, to sort of begin with, I think there's a perception both, the media and the general public that, this is all expected. This is Haiti. This is just business as usual. And I think it's important to take a step back and realize the role that our government in the U.S. and other international actors, the United Nations, the Organization of American States, the European Union, et cetera, have played in actually fomenting these issues and directly contributing to the current crisis. Currently, elections, the second round presidential elections, are scheduled for January 24th. This decree was made by President Martelly just yesterday. And so we're talking about an extremely tight timeline and an election which, no matter what, will not be seen as legitimate in the eyes of many Haitians. There have been a number of recommendations and things that need to be fixed in order for this election to be run more smoothly. And yet, obviously, 2 weeks will not be enough time for that to be implemented. Now, rather than sort of blindly marching forward and pushing forward with an election schedule that just works as fast as possible, a much more sort of democratic outcome would be taking a step back and actually getting the situation right before moving forward. And I think, sort of the biggest rationale for this is simply looking at what happened in 2010, as we discussed earlier, and seeing the negative impacts of 5 years of an illegitimate government, whereas, the sort of short-term risk, short-term pain of having a period of transitional government or some other caretaker institution to lead us to a cleaner election will be much greater for the long run.
We've been speaking with Jake Johnston from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can find them and the Haiti Relief and Reconstruction Watch project online at cepr.net. Thank you so much, Jake Johnston, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered this week by Kelly Spivey. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock in this new year of 2016. In this program, I'll talk with two guests who will tell us about the erosion of civilizations, climate answers in the soil, and the danger of killing off your own ecology of microbes in your body. But first, in this new year, I need a little time to talk with you. I suppose I knew it would come to this. We've just flashed past another awful marker towards a new climate age. At the end of 2015, the hottest year ever recorded, it rained in the 24-hour darkness at the North Pole. You remember where you were on September 11, 2001? You knew it was a giant marker where nothing would ever be the same. Scientists around the world felt the same dread and awe in 2007 when the Arctic ice melted back, revealing a dark sea to the sky. For the first time in many thousands of years, maybe even in millions of years, it wasn't supposed to happen this century. We knew then the Arctic would never recover. The pendulum swung towards the great melting. More heat from the sun would be absorbed by the planet, changing the energy balance not just in the Arctic, but everywhere. We've run interviews with scientists like Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers, explaining how the loss of that white shield at the top of the world and a warming Arctic has changed the jet stream. With less difference between the polar cold and the tropics, those high atmospheric winds have morphed from a powerful west-to-east stream to a meandering river. That river has bends that tend to freeze over regions and extending the breadth of continents and beyond. As Paul Beckwith has told us, what you get on the ground depends on which side of the stream you are on. It can be extra hot in the west and extra snowy in the east, or vice versa. Lately, in the Northern Hemisphere, we have not had the record-breaking hurricanes that slammed into North America in 2005. We have had straight-running power winds called derechos. Multiple massive hurricanes called typhoons in the Southern Hemisphere hit East Asia this year. The Philippines was raked over time after time. What the Northern Hemisphere experienced in late 2015 reminds me of this quote from Dr. James Hansen in his book, Storms of My Grandchildren. He wrote, "Continent-sized frontal storms packing the strength of hurricanes." Robert Scribler reminded me of that, and that is what we have really had in this December. Hansen writes about such megastorms as coming in the future in the next generation. I say we are seeing it now. In fact, we have just experienced another transcontinental storm stretching from California beyond Scandinavia with waves reaching Russian Siberia. This story is written in heat maps of the ocean as measured from satellites. Scientists say up to 90% of the excess heat or energy created by a more carbon-rich atmosphere has been soaked up by the oceans. That's a slow process, slow to heat and slow to release. With that buffer, there is at least a 30-year delay for the impacts of our carbon emissions. The climate disruption we're feeling now is from rising greenhouse gas emissions in the 1980s. We poured in almost as much again since then. The oceans of the world communicate slowly, sometimes at great depth, using the system known as the Great Conveyor Belt. The seas have been hot and getting hotter around Australia, the Philippines, Indonesia, and in East Asia generally. That heat has been moving downward towards the depths for about 15 years since the last great El Niño of 1997-98. It mixes with colder waters below, which rising create the La Niña weather systems we've taken for granted in this new century. That cycle has to break. It always does, and now we have El Niño, but with the hotter seas, it's El Niño on steroids. It's the strongest El Niño recorded since the development of science. You will hear endless collections of weather people on television explaining the floods and soon snowstorms and even the strange warming in eastern North America on El Niño. That's why the cherry blossoms bloomed all up the East Coast. That's why folks in Philadelphia wore shorts and T-shirts on Christmas Day, they say. I've seen a report that out of over 200 local and national newscasts monitored, only one even talked about the possible role of global warming. That's in the United States. The other suspect, and notice we are never the suspects, the other suspect is called changes in the jet stream. Well, that's true. But why don't they ask, and why don't we ask, why is this such a strong El Nino? Why has the jet stream changed? Why is the weather so weird? And why is it never going to be normal again? Usually scientists tell us El Nino has little impact on the Atlantic Ocean. It's an affair of the Pacific. And yet, we now see storms that blow over Texas, Missouri, and eastwards seeming to continue on. In just days, there are record winds in Iceland and still more flooding across Ireland, Scotland, England, and Scandinavia. In those ocean heat maps, we can see raging heat in the seas off New England. It's been so hot, the species are changing. It's still relatively warmer this winter, but that warmer water is being pushed away from Greenland by a new phenomenon that will stay with us, likely for centuries. We now realize that massive meltwater from Greenland has created a pond of cold water in the very North Atlantic. It's like putting ice into a drink, and the ocean there is colder than it was even with global warming. So where are the hot waters of the Gulf Stream to go? They are pushed lower, heading towards Europe. The clash of the Greenland cold blob and these record hot waters create mega storms and a storm track that is battering the British Isles again this winter. Centuries-old towns that have not flooded since the Middle Ages are flooded now. Historic bridges have washed away. In England, they call this Storm Frank, but it stretches from Spain to the North Pole. Yes, the mania to contain everything in concrete has had an effect there. All those new suburbs and their roads, all the moors drained to raise grouse for the rich, all our activities have disturbed nature's buffers for heavy rains. Does any of that really matter when more than a foot of rain drops from the sky in just 24 hours? No one alive in Great Britain has seen anything like this. It doesn't stop there, or even with the big floods in Norway. The heated waters are pouring up the Norwegian coast and into the Arctic, above Finland and above Russia. There is a rural inhabited area in central eastern Siberia called Katanga. According to Wikipedia, the previous December high for Katanga was minus 0.2 degrees C, or 31.6 degrees Fahrenheit. That was the record high. And the average high in December is minus 25.5 C, or minus 13 Fahrenheit. That's the general average. Blogger Robin Wenstra tells us that there in the Arctic Circle this December in Katanga, it was 79 degrees Fahrenheit, or 26 degrees Celsius. I can't begin to tell you how insane and how impossible that is. Here I'm just going to quote from Robert Scribler's blog. He says it so well, nobody can say it better. Unprecedented doesn't even begin to describe rain over the Arctic sea ice above the 80-degree north latitude line on the evening of Tuesday, December 29, 2015. It's something we'd rarely see during the summertime, but this rain is falling through the black polar night during the coldest time of the year. There, over the Arctic sea ice today, the rains began in wintertime. As the first front of warm air proceeded over the ice pack to the north of Svalbard, the rains fell through 35 to 40 degree Fahrenheit air temperatures. It splattered upon Arctic Ocean ice that rarely even sees rain during the summertime. Its soft pitter-patter, a whisper that may well be the sound to mark the end of a geological age. For we don't just see rain over the Arctic sea ice north of Greenland during winter time, or we used to not, but the warmth, that liquid water falling through the black of what should be a bone-cold polar night represents something ominous, something ushered to our world by human fossil fuel industry's tremendous emission of heat-trapping gases, gases that in the range of 400 parts per million CO2 and 485 parts per million CO2 equivalent, are now strong enough to begin to roll back the grip of winter. Gases that if they keep being burned until we hit a range of between 550 to 650 parts per million of CO2, will likely be powerful enough to wipe out winter as we know it entirely over the course of long and tumultuous years of painful transition. What does the beginning of winter sound like? It's the soft splash of rain over the Arctic Ocean sea ice during what should be its coldest season. That's a quote from Robert Scribler's blog. So you see, that is a 9/11 moment that hardly anyone else knows about. In fact, it's far greater than mere terrorism or human wars over religion and oil. At Christmas 2015, we saw, as Robert says, the beginning of the end of winter. I suspected the time would come when I could just rebroadcast old Radio EcoShock shows, since the truth about climate change is already known, already told, and now already come. I said what we've seen is just another transcontinental storm. That's because I first noticed one in 2006, the year I began this radio show. I had to dig out that old Radio EcoShock show from the archives on our website. I think you'll agree, it's eerily familiar, except now we've had another 10 years of great science, very driven science, to explain why these things are happening. So here it is, from Radio EcoShock in 2006, as I describe a transcontinental storm that sounds so much like today.
Time, weather, and...
Across the UK, at least 10 people were killed as trees snapped and walls collapsed. On the roads, heavy-duty trucks were blown over like toys.
For the first time in its history, virtually the entire rail network was shut.
It's bad.
Hundreds of utility poles have snapped in half.
It's the worst thing we've ever seen, really. No power anywhere.
In the Dutch port of Rotterdam, a major alert was sparked after a ship broke loose from its moorings, smashing an oil pipeline.
On the roads, heavy-duty trucks were blown over like toys.
This storm has torn across northern Europe, leaving chaos and death in its wake.
Missouri's governor says this is the worst natural disaster in his state's history.
And the same storm whipping up fierce winds in Switzerland, powerful enough to knock a locomotive and several cars right off the rails.
The storm is now sweeping northward into Scandinavia and eastwards towards Poland.
And backing up traffic for miles.
I've seen this thing get shut down, but never like this. It's never been this bad.
Devastation is also piled up on roads from Texas to North Carolina. Since Friday, at least 66 people in 9 states have been killed in storm-related deaths.
And they always find a chorus of meteorologists to claim, well, no, it's not climate change. Sometimes things just get stormy. Maybe it's El Nino. Maybe it's spots on the sun. Maybe it's HARP coming out of Alaska. Anything but climate change. This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock reporting on the new stormy future, what we should worry about when it comes to climate change and storms.
But meteorologists warn against drawing an immediate link between these extreme weather conditions and the effects of climate change.
Do these media reports worry you? Take a deep breath. Humans are hardwired to fear extreme climate events. Mammals instinctively don't like big windstorms, big piles of snow, or big waves crashing against the shore. These are not just the first big storms. A trio of storms that hit Europe in 1999 were worse than the January blow and killed more people. History still remembers violent weather there in the 1300s. People thought those storms were caused by God due to our sins rather than climate change. Our only remedy for this natural fear and our religious reactions to it is science. The problem is, now the science is scarier than Jove or Jehovah. The new mantra goes like this. Meteorologists say you cannot prove this latest strong weather came from climate change. Climate scientists agree the causes of a specific storm cannot be certain, but the long-term impacts of the atmosphere are predictable. The Earth will get hotter. A lot of that heat will be soaked up by the oceans. Warmer oceans mean more water gets sucked up into the atmosphere, causing more violent precipitation, which could be rain or snow. The hotter oceans also add more power to existing storms. We may not get more storms, but those that do form will be stronger. Nobody needs to be reminded that all kinds of hurricane records were set in 2005. Hurricane Wilma was the biggest ever recorded, and Katrina the most damaging to a developed city. There were so many hurricanes, the weather experts ran out of internationally accepted names for them. Then 2006 was relatively quiet. Again, the studies of long-term records by people like Kerry Emanuel show we may not have more storms, but they will be more powerful. What does it all mean? Let's make a couple of homespun observations about this recent series of storms.
And tonight, this massive storm running the length of the country continues to dump snow, ice, and freezing rain.
Number one, this was a transcontinental storm. Within the same week, weird and wild weather stretched all the way from California to New England and hit England, Scandinavia, and all of Europe from west to east.
What's unusual about this storm is that it will affect all of Germany and not just certain zones. That is a very rare event.
Most of the Northern Hemisphere was engulfed in an extreme weather event. That is worth worrying about. As the climate becomes destabilized by carbon emissions and various feedbacks, is it possible we may see global storms? Just think about what this might mean to the economy and how limited rescue efforts might be in the future superstorm.
And there's no word from the electricity companies when the power will be back.
Observation number two, the European storm was not a hurricane. Hurricanes and their tropical counterparts, the typhoons, involve a spinning mass of air and water. The speed and damage of the wind depend upon rotation around a central vortex. But the blast that hit Europe was described as a river of wind crossing the continent. It was almost as though the jet stream had dipped down to Earth, blowing along the surface at over 100 miles an hour. That is the sort of science fiction scenario described in the 1994 book Heavy Weather by Bruce Sterling. Following a period of industrial damage to the Earth's atmosphere, a more or less permanent storm developed in the U.S. Midwest, a new category beyond our current ranking system. Here in the real world, meteorologists are already discussing the need to add a new class, the F6 hurricane, to top the existing worst-case F5 type. With climate change, they expect storms stronger than anything humans have seen in the last 10,000 years. But again, the rest of us have to wonder if the jet stream will not become a bigger factor for the Northern Hemisphere. When we looked at the big satellite pictures and maps, there was a strong line running right across the southern half of North America and then jagging up toward Europe. Are disturbances to the jet stream linked to the transcontinental storms like the ones we just experienced? More science has to investigate that.
In California, five straight nights of freezing temperatures threatened to destroy 75% of the state's billion-dollar citrus crop.
If we're a total loss from this point, we would have lost $700 million.
Observation three, North Americans already know the price of their fruits and vegetables will go up in the next few weeks. That is because up to 75% of the fruit and winter vegetables for North America come from just a few valleys in Southern California. Those valleys were hit by freezing temperatures that put ice around the crops when only 30% had been harvested. Governor Schwarzenegger estimated a $1 billion loss for the citrus industry alone. The point is, climate instability will damage the world's ability to feed itself. Higher prices for oranges are only an inconvenience for the rich, but the poorest people will starve by the millions as rising temperatures, storms, and reduced water supplies reduce our output of wheat, corn, and rice. Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute says a change of just a half a degree could reduce the rice crop by 20%. And we are going to get a lot more than that, perhaps 2 to 5 degrees change. The storm is an early warning about the coming food deficit as climate destabilizes agriculture. What do we learn from these storms? Our energy and transportation systems are complicated and delicate. They need to be storm-proofed, but that's a giant economic project, taking decades. Can we afford it economically? Can we do it? These are all direct costs brought on by climate change through fossil fuels. Countries that adapt may stumble through. Those who don't react to the new climate imperative will fail. Business and personal lives will be repeatedly interrupted by jagged, damaging power outages. It's hard to say how people will react. Like passengers rushing to the high side of a boat, there has been a stampede of political pronouncements on climate change action. Ultra-conservatives, even big oil companies, are saying it is time to act. The media are developing climate change desks, and newspapers devote whole features to it. It's the hot topic, for now.
Of course, humans have a notoriously short attention span. Soon we'll all be sick of hearing about it, and the big media spotlight will move on to some other celebrity scandal or war. We may say some oceanside real estate will go down in value or be relegated to seasonal use only. Storm surges will wipe out billions of dollars in value, and insurance will be impossible to get. That's already happening. We may have to put most of the state of Florida in that category. One more conclusion. As the decade progresses, the price of food will continue to escalate from a minor budget item to something as large as the mortgage. The ocean grabs enough heat to act like a 30-year buffer. Our current climate troubles come from carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions from the late 1970s. But experts estimate half our greenhouse gas emissions went into the atmosphere since 1970. That means you ain't seen nothing yet. It also means that all the new clean energy we add now and all the CO2 we manage to conserve or reduce will have no impact until about 2036. For the first time in our recent consumerist history, we will have to act for the next generation, even though there is no direct benefit for ourselves. Can we do it? Or will we party like it's 1999? It's true we can't blame one storm on climate change, but we do know some storms will be much worse because of global warming. Those extreme events may finally spook the herd into action. When older people tell newscasters, "I've never seen anything like this." When new records are set. When the German train system closes down for the first time. Hell, they didn't even close the whole system when it was being bombed in World War II. The rest of us are not overreacting. Nature is trying to tell us something. We are doing something wrong, and it isn't mystical or religious. It is factual, measurable, and all powered by fossil fuels. This is Alex Smith reporting from Radio EcoShock.
But this storm that used to happen once every century could come once every 10 years, and maybe more often than that.
You can expect significant flooding every 2 years. So those are the changes that we are seeing for the future.
An abandoned cargo ship loaded with hazardous materials is being battered by stormy seas in the English Channel. French and British tugboats are trying to prevent the vessel from going under and creating a massive chemical spill.
That was a rebroadcast from Radio EcoShock 2006.
I have to admit, even though I love it, it's painful to make this Radio EcoShock show. I hope it's not too painful for you to hear. For whatever strange reason, it hurts me to think of rain falling in the winter Arctic. I know that means more people flooded out of their peaceful homes, good people flooded out or blown out of them further south. I know that means millions of trees will die in California from the drought, including some of the ancient giants. I know that farmers will struggle, and we will pay more for what can be run through the great weather gauntlet. I know the creatures in the sea are suffering. I know it will get harder and worse. I know too much. Over Christmas, I played with my grandson. We made towers where marbles roll down through mazes. We read stories about lions and elephants. Will they still exist when he's grown? Will everything around him be tossed about by fires, strange frosts, weird rains? What will I tell him if we give up and stop trying to save what's left? What will you tell the children that you did during the great climate crisis? All this was driven deeper by the sudden news that over Christmas we nearly lost a powerful climate warrior. You may remember how Daphne Wisham organized the conference call of mayors and activists against building more fossil fuel infrastructure, things like pipelines and oil ports, coal ports. One was just approved in Australia, a horrible thing. For 8 years, Daphne hosted the syndicated radio show Earthbeat. She recommended Radio EcoShock to those stations. Daphne has been fighting to save the climate from her new home in Portland, Oregon. Just before Christmas, Daphne and her partner suddenly found themselves plunging into a cold mountain river, their car sinking fast. She was deep in the water, gulping air from a tiny pocket, for many long minutes before a sheriff's deputy managed to rescue her. Both Daphne and her partner were airlifted to a Reno hospital. Both are going to recover.
Daphne has already declared another year of continuing battle to prevent catastrophic climate change. We need her so badly. So life is short and tenuous. We have a few thousand years of human history behind us, and millennia yet to come for all the creatures. What changes will we leave in our short visit here on Earth? I shudder to imagine what our descendants will think of us as we rush to buy more things in the stores, to fly off on tropical vacations, to waste away the world. Or did we strive to localize food without petrochemicals? Did we walk or bike more than drive? Did we use social media and circles of our friends to create allies? Is this the year, after the polar rain, after the transcontinental storms, that we break out of the deadly paradigm of the old fossil age? You decide what you do with your life and powers. I'll keep making radio and keep talking with scientists and activists. I'll wrap up this selfish little chat with a powerful comment left on the Radio EcoShock blog following last week's optimistic talk by scientist and author Tim Flannery. Listener Wanda Harding wrote this: I would like to be positive, but it seems to me that all these solutions are dreamed up to allow for the current capitalistic system to continue when, and I'm going to say it this way, we know that is really a big part of the problem. I do not see any ideas about reducing consumption, especially for the rich, less flying, less buying. We just want to keep buying cars and stupid plastic stuff that we do not need. I do not hear anything about coming up with a whole new global culture that is not about consuming, especially things we do not need and activities we shouldn't be doing, like professional sports and NASCAR. Also, Tim brings up women in developing countries needing birth control. Yes, they do, and I'm all for them having it, and I bet they really want it. However, why do we allow the upper classes, the rich, to do whatever they want? Why do they not have to change their lifestyles? Oh, wait, gee, they have to buy an electric car. When someone says there is a law passed that states that anyone making over maybe $150,000 a year is legally required to put some type of renewable energy system on their home, then we will start to make some progress. When the rich or even the business sector is legally limited to how much they can fly, or even if they can fly, then I'll believe we are making progress. When we start to really go in the direction of small farmers and use that as a jobs creation program and give out land grants for people to do so, and then they don't have to travel to work in rural areas, negating the necessity of a car, at least not having to run one every day, then I'll start to believe we are making progress. So far, all we do is come up with gadgets, and we still do not believe we have to change our behaviors and lifestyles. Thank you, Wanda Harding. You see how it is? I know many of my listeners are powerful and articulate people. I appreciate so much all the emails you send me. You can write me anytime, radio@ecoshock.org. In fact, without listener tips, ideas, and criticism from all over the world, I simply could not continue this program. Radio EcoShock has become listener-powered. Thank you for giving me another year of opportunity, as hard as the news may be. I've got some great guests lined up for you, including a top scientist from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, to explain this year's Arctic Report Card that's coming up. But let's get to our first guests of 2016 right now.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. We are going to take a big journey into time and across the globe. Eventually, we'll get right back to the center of your own body. Our tour guides are Dr. David Montgomery from the University of Washington and biologist Anne Beakley. David and Anne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, thank you.
I know the two of you just released a new book, The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. That's a personal journey with a big message for us all. But at the risk of being rude, I'd like to start with you, David. A recent guest, Benoit Lambert, and several listeners asked for this interview based on your previous book, Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations. That's coming back, and not only because we may farm ourselves right out of the soil in this century, but also because of that promise we could reverse the process, putting big amounts of carbon back into the soil, and maybe avert catastrophic climate change. Okay, well now, to be blunt, we're all busy people. Why should we care about what happens to dirt? Can you give us the nutshell on that one?
Well, yeah, you know, if you look around the world today at the areas that we sort of find to be perennially troublesome hotspots, places like Syria and Libya, for example, they're places that long ago those societies essentially degraded and destroyed their soils, and they've been impoverished ever since. So if we can look at healthy, fertile soil quite literally as the foundation, both ecological and economic, for healthy, thriving civilizations. And that's something that all of us really have a stake in. And if you then take it sort of further to our own food and nutrition and bodies, as we do in the new book, there's connections to our personal health as well. Yet we tend to take soil for granted. And this has gotten societies into trouble in the past. But as you alluded to, there's certain causes for optimism these days in terms of thinking about what a different way of thinking about our soil can do for some of the big problems we face.
Well, it's a bit different now because we're globalized. I mean, if China right now is buying up farmland in Africa, if that land gets overused and then can't produce, there are global repercussions. Don't you think it's a bit of a game changer when we can't just move on to a new continent and try farming there?
No, exactly. That is the big concern for this sort of most recent round of sort of land use abuse and soil degradation that we're going through. Societies in the past have been able to sort of, you know, move laterally to different places, to new and fresh soils. And the United States is an example of a country that has done this over the last several hundred years. But we're really out of land that we might potentially farm over the long run that we're not already farming. So we don't really have anywhere else to go if we spoil the health of the land this time around. We really have to get it right this time.
Yeah, I don't think the soils on Mars are going to cut it.
No, they're you know, you look at the chemistry, it's really sort of battery acid. It's not really healthy, fertile soil, and they're missing the microbes for all that we know, and the atmosphere is not that conducive. No, we're not. If we ever terraform Mars, it's going to be a long time from now. It's not getting us through this century.
I was surprised to learn from you that soil erosion was already a problem in America before there was the United States. The fathers of the country wrote about it. What was happening in colonial America?
Yeah, well, you know, the crop that got colonial America off the ground economically and its relationship with Europe, so that goods would keep going back and forth and feed the sort of the fuels of the economic fire, was tobacco. And tobacco was a crop, the way it was cultivated colonially, and in some places still today, was very erosive and hard on the soil. So you could essentially get 3 to 5 years of a very productive, profitable crop out of a piece of land that you'd cleared before you had to move on to fresh land to clear again and start the process all over again. And that led in part to the rise of plantation agriculture because they needed large acreages to be able to keep moving around where one farmed over time. And the degradation of the soil over time in colonial North America became important in the sense that it started to decrease crop yields, it started to impact the economy. And people at the very top of American society, the highest echelons, people like Washington and Jefferson and Franklin, noticed the problem and worked on trying to bring crop rotations in and fill in gullies and to try to work to rebuild soil fertility. But the vast majority of planters in the colonies did not sort of follow those kind of recommendations. And it gradually, as Washington predicted, drove the American people inland, westward, to continue the search for new and fertile land on the other side of the mountains.
But even when they got there, I've seen a photo of a church in Iowa that's about 8 feet above the surrounding lands. Can we lose that amount of soil that fast?
Oh, yeah. You know, year to year, it doesn't seem to happen all that fast. But if you keep up something that goes even just like a few millimeters a year, if you keep that up for centuries, it can really add up to burning through the topsoil. And that example of the churchyard, it's perched on a person-high pedestal of soil as the surrounding farmlands eroded away, is a pretty dramatic example. But it's a good illustration of essentially what can happen over time if we have practices that lead to eroding soils faster than we're rebuilding them or than in fact nature can make them.
But what are we going to do here, David? I mean, we can't give up farming. That's how we feed the billions of people on the earth.
Oh, yeah. No, we got what we need to do is figure out ways of farming that can actually restore and rebuild and then maintain soil fertility and the physical body of the soil itself, even while we use it to intensively grow food. And I've spent the last 6 months actually touring around farms around the world looking at farmers whose practices can actually do that and turn this problem around. It's a set of processes that I sort of first became aware of actually by watching my wife garden and transform our yard in North Seattle from a barren lot into a lush garden. And the idea that you could, through the way you managed organic matter on the landscape, reignite the microbial fires, the microbial life that fuel the turnover of nutrients that drive soil fertility, it was a real eye-opener to me. And then those same kind of principles, it turns out, are things that are being practiced in conservation agriculture to actually rebuild fertility to soils, improve crop yields, sequester carbon in agricultural soils, things that you can view as long-term investments in our ability to keep our agricultural enterprise actually fruitful and productive over the long run.
In the big agribusiness, it seems like we're almost doing hydroponics. I mean, we just use the soil as something to hold the plants upright while we feed them fossil fuels, but we're going to run out of fossil fuels eventually, or maybe they'll be banned as climate disruption unfolds. If we let our soil become lifeless places, what happens then?
Well, then you can, if we really play it to conclusion, we're back to those examples of Libya and Syria, because that's sort of the end game. We don't want to get there. And you're right about the sort of 20th century philosophy of looking at soil as just something to hold the plants up while we add the nutrients. That's going to have to change this century for a host of reasons, not the least of which is as the price of fossil fuels goes up, whether from scarcity or from design as we try and wean ourselves off of them, it would behoove us to try and figure out less energy-intensive ways to farm and re-enlisting the microbial allies that plants have in soils and doing that on our farms is a way to try and push that forward. And it turns out that's sort of a would require a change in thinking of agricultural practices from one of treating the soil as a medium to hold those chemicals that we would add to fertilize the ground, to instead trying to recultivate the microbial life with organic matter that would help accelerate the processes of both nutrient extraction from rocks and minerals, but also the turnover and the recycling of the nutrients that are in that organic matter. And that requires a different set of practices, a different way of thinking about the soil and prioritizing soil health and those practices that can rebuild the health and integrity of the biological component of soils, particularly microbial life and then the larger soil life that feeds on them and essentially functions like tiny livestock in our soils. It's fairly easy to picture about how, you know, sort of the livestock we know, cattle and bison and sheep and so forth, how their manure helps to close the cycle of returning nutrients back to the land. Microbial life below ground does very similar things, but it's out of sight, out of mind, and literally invisible. But it can be just as important in terms of maintaining fertility. But to cultivate the beneficial life in the soil, we have to change what we call conventional agriculture to practices that actually foster and support that life.
How did we get this far into the interview without saying the word plow?
Yeah, if you look at the one of the big forces that has driven the degradation of soils around the world, the plow is, you know, comes immediately to mind, and that was a major thrust of the book Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations, where as a geologist I started to look into what sort of the factors that helped drive the decline of ancient societies, and I ended up writing essentially a history of farming, and the plow played a big role in causing the erosion of soils around the world where in those places where it was used. And it really did it two ways. One, from just direct movement of soil. When you plow across a hillside, you're moving dirt. And if you keep going at the same direction and bias over the long run and keep doing it, you're moving stuff downhill. You're accelerating the removal of soil off of the hilltops and parking it in the valley bottoms. And that can reduce the total area that you could have to farm. But what the plow also does is what it's designed to do. It inverts the soil. It leaves the soil bare and vulnerable to erosion by wind or rain for some portion of the year. And that can allow soil erosion to race ahead of soil production such that you're actually losing soil. And if that plays out over long enough, centuries as it turns out, you can essentially strip the soil right off the landscape. And it can take nature a long time to put it back because nature forms soils fairly slowly. But the lesson that Ann taught me in our yard was essentially that people through the application of labor and energy and organic matter and enlisting microbial helpers, trillions of microbial assistants, we can actually rebuild soils much faster than nature tends to do on her own.
Well, I am a backyard gardener, so I'm pretty excited to be talking to Ann about that in just a minute. I want to cover just a couple more things from your previous work. I've had a series of guests talking about how to put carbon back into the soil and using biochar as a longer-term solution for climate change. Is this serious stuff? Can it work?
The short answer is yes. Could it actually sort of solve the climate problem? Well, that's sort of a bigger question that I'm not going to give you a solid answer on, because I've seen very widely disparate estimates of how much carbon we could park back in the soil. But the key answer from my perspective is the farming practices that actually return carbon back to the land through cover cropping and encouraging, again, this microbial life to increase the standing stock of organic matter in soils. You know, if we could do that over agricultural land globally, it would take a huge bite out of the carbon in the atmosphere that we've added over the last century and a half. Biochar is a really interesting and very effective technology for parking carbon. It takes a long time for it to break down. You know, it obviously doesn't store it forever, but it can store it in forms that, that take a long time to break down, and it doesn't directly influence the fertility of the soil in the sense that the plants aren't sucking up the charcoal. But it I like to view it as you're building habitat for microbes that can then assist in the cycling of nutrients, and it can boost fertility in that regard. And it's also really good at holding moisture, holding water, something that it could be very useful in terms of a changing climate. And I look at the whole issue about whether we should be doing practices in agriculture, both the cover cropping angle and the biochar angle, that could increase the carbon content of our soils is something that it's one of the few investments we could make that could simultaneously help feed the world of tomorrow, rebuild soil fertility, but also help draw down atmospheric carbon dioxide. And many of the practices that actually help build soil carbon also require less in the way of fossil fuel inputs. So you're not only sequestering carbon, you're turning down emissions if we've made many of these kinds of changes in agricultural practices.
But I do know the French government brought carbon farming, they call it agroecology, to the Paris COP21 meeting. Have you heard any plans by any government in the world to start restoring soils in a serious way?
No, that Minister LaFalle's proposal to do that was the first time I'd heard the ideas being taken seriously at that level, and I think it's absolutely fabulous because we really do need to aggressively move towards doing that. And the farms that I've looked at in the last 6 months who have been increasing the carbon content of their soils fall right into that range that he was talking about. I'm saying, you know, 0.4% a year, or 0.5% of soil organic matter per year is feasible to reintroduce back into soil. So you look at the net acreage of farmland around the world. If we could do that everywhere and do it aggressively, it could make a huge difference. And it's one of the few technologies that's available that could actually improve the bottom line on farms by reducing our agrochemical inputs. It really is an idea whose time has come. I'm working on a new book now that sort of explores that through this farms around the world. And we should be promoting those ideas in a very, very serious way, and not just for the climate issue, but also to help solve the problem of how we're going to feed ourselves in the future. And it would also help with the biodiversity problem, because to a large degree, if we look at the area of the continents that are covered by agriculture, the kind of life that's going to be surviving along with us over for the next several hundred years, what we do on our farms is going to make a big difference to the species that are going to be able to stick around over the long run. For all those reasons, we ought to be encouraging those kind of activities.
This is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking mostly about David Montgomery's earlier book, Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations. But when we get to soil restoration, Montgomery has a research partner who has experimented in their own back garden, biologist Ann Bilkay. And let's get you in here. What was the challenge in your Seattle backyard, and what did you do about it?
Yeah, what happened was I had long wanted a garden. And when we finally were able to buy a house in Seattle, one of the reasons that we bought it is that it had this big side yard. And growing in that side yard was sort of this thicket of dandelions and maybe almost century-old grass. And so I saw this as one big blank slate. So what we did when we started our project was we peeled all of that right off of the lot And then when we looked at our soil, we went, oh my God, what are we going to do? This stuff is kind of sandy, khaki, light colored. It's filled with a lot of rocks because of Seattle's glacial history. And there was just hardly any organic matter at all. And we also got stuck sort of because of construction delays and so forth with putting the plants in the ground at about the worst time of the year possible, late July. And once the plants were in the ground, I had done enough gardening to know that we needed to get something on top of this soil, both to start feeding the soil, and which thereby feeding the plants, but also to help us keep water in the ground during that first summer. So that's kind of where it all started.
It may seem like a small point, but if I dump a ton of manure on my back garden, my neighbors will not thank me. How did you get around that?
Well, that's interesting, because before we had our house, I brought manure home to the place that we were renting, and it wasn't our neighbor that objected so much. Oddly enough, it was my husband who said, "What is that smell, and what have you done?" And I tried to calm him down, and I told him, this smell will go away, but just wait till you see what it does to the plants. And in the case of the garden where we're now living, I didn't get any animal manures. By that time, we had sort of blown our budget on various other things for the garden, and the organic matter that we got came very locally. It came from me collecting neighbors' leaves. In particular, oak leaves make a really nice ingredient for a mulch. And every time I heard the sound of an arborist wood chipper in the neighborhood, I would track them down and pressure them to drop the wood chips off in our driveway. And then the other great source of organic matter, it's a source of nitrogen, is coffee grounds and espresso grounds. And there's, you know, heaps and heaps of that stuff laying around town. So those were sort of my three main ingredients. And then later on, we moved onto a worm bin and began doing a little bit of vermicomposting.
So, and now we get to a big plot twist. You are researching how to restore microbial life to the soils, but then something changed in your life that helped result in this new book with David. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So we've been going along thrilled and enthralled with what the microbial world had done to transform our soil and our garden, and that had transformed our lives. There's no doubt about that. But then in about 2011, I got the kind of phone call from one's doctor that you never want to get. And I learned that I had a malignant cancer. Not only that, but that this cancer was caused by a microbe, by a virus. And so this sort of whiplashed my head, you know, right back the other way. And I wondered, oh, my God, what really is this microbial world? This has got this huge duality about it. You know, on the one hand, hugely beneficial, not only my experience, but we know through human history that microbes have interacted with us a lot through infectious diseases. So all this is sort of percolating around in our lives and in our minds. And it was around that time that we began to also dig into some of the microbiome research. And so the microbiome, it's funny, it's sort of this old field, but it's also sort of this new field. And we've known for a long, long time that microbes live on us. And certainly the plant scientists know that microbes live in the soil and on plants. But the new angle on all of this is that we're now able to figure out what some of these microbials are, like who are their members, what are the genomes of these microbes, and what do their genes allow them to do? And it turns out that in many respects, we are more microbial than we are ourselves. And so as we're, you know, parsing through this research and I'm recovering from a horrendous surgery from cancer, it just sort of formed a backdrop for where does our health really come from? You know, is it from doctor's offices and drugs? But, you know, what about this whole new field of research that's turning up a lot of evidence that microbes are, you know, in some ways underpinning the health of ourselves? That was sort of the big plot twist in the book and how we then began to really dig into the human biology end of things.
We've talked with David about how our methods of agriculture have killed off a lot of the soil life. Did you find that our diets and our lifestyles are killing off beneficial microbes in our own bodies?
Yeah, well, that's sort of the leading hypothesis amongst microbiome researchers. And they think there's, at this point, two main factors for that, which are certainly since around World War II, our intake of antibiotics has increased hugely. And that is sort of the equivalent, you know, of a pesticide or an herbicide, but right inside of our bodies. And, you know, in some cases, there are some really bad actors that gain a foothold, and you do want to have ways to exterminate them. But the whole problem with antibiotics is that some are very broad spectrum, and so you're taking out all of our allies along with, you know, the one or two bad actors. So antibiotics have certainly had some effect on our microbiome. The other thing, which is not quite so straightforward as to how it might impact our microbiome, is our diet. And that's where there's some really pretty interesting parallels between what's going on with agricultural soils and the microbial life and what's going on with what David and I sort of came to see is this parallel world of soil that is deep within our guts. In fact, right down at the bottom of our gut in our colons, you might liken that part of our anatomy and biology to a garden or to a farm, because turns out that, you know, that's where the lion's share of the trillions of microbial cells that are on and in our bodies actually dwell. It's sort of the creme de la creme, if you will, of the most biodiverse part of our bodies is in our colons.
And people don't like to talk about this. Have you encountered resistance?
No, we don't. We call it, you know, the least loved part of the body. We've been doing some talks on the book in the last several weeks, and part of that, the talk includes, we've got a PowerPoint that goes with it, and we've got some great figures of the colon. And, you know, this is pretty much what we have to say to people is, you know, look, we've all got to start thinking very differently and actually talking very differently about our colons, because the fact is, they are not some kind of onboard garbage can at all. They are this alchemical cauldron in which medicinal compounds are being produced that are not only just absolutely critical to the health of our colons, but it's looking like some of those compounds actually diffuse into our bloodstream and are distributed throughout the rest of our body. So what we really have is not an onboard garbage can. In many ways, it's like this onboard pharmacy, and it's our microbes who are, you know, conjuring up the drugs that fill up our pharmacy shelves right there in our colon.
Well, this conjures up what might be a dumb question for either of you, David or Ann, and that is, are the microbes that literally allow plants to feed, are they similar or different to the microbes in our guts that enable our own lives?
Well, one thing about the human microbiome is that many of these microbes live nowhere else except in our gut. So in that sense, they're indigenous to us and they are not found anywhere else. There's many discoveries yet to be made, however, in the microbiome of the soil and of our bodies. And one of the challenges in this field is that you used to be able to get a microbe and culture it in a lab and you'd know what it was and what it looked like and what it did. But vast, vast majority of bacteria and many other microbes, you can't culture them outside of their native habitats. So whether that's the soil or the gut, we still don't, I think, quite know if there might be some overlap between maybe a few of the things that are in our bodies and a few of the things that are in our soil. We do know that the functions of these microbes are identical in that in the soil, they're breaking down plant-based organic matter. And the very same thing is happening in our colons. We humans lack many of the enzymes that are needed to break down the complex carbohydrates or what, you know, chemists call polysaccharides in the plant foods. And so, you know, we send them down the hatch. They pass through our stomach, through our small intestine, more or less undigested. Then they hit the colon, and then that's where the breakdown begins. So it's sort of like one big mulch fest down there. I think it would be really interesting to do a comparison of, you know, what do we find in the soil microbiome versus the gut of humans.
You've taught me something I just didn't know, you know, and I should have known by now I always thought that it was the stomach that broke down food and that's where we got our nutrients. But you're saying, no, it happens much lower down.
Well, what's interesting is the stomach's really sort of filled with gastric acids. And so there's dissolving of food starch in the stomach. But the absorption of the nutrients in the food, that doesn't happen until small intestine and colon. And so the foods that we have the enzymes to break down, much of that is absorbed in the small intestine. So that's like your simple carbohydrates. It's broken down, easily absorbed in the small intestine. It's the larger and more complex molecules that pass into the colon, and that's where our microbiota get to work on them. They're actually fermenting them. Another way to maybe think about your colon, I don't know if this is appealing to your listeners or not, but I'll just put it out there. It's, in a way, you know, the whole rage about getting your sauerkraut crock pot out and fermenting cabbage or other vegetables or foods. We've got an onboard fermenter, and that is our colon. So that's where much of the digestion and absorption of other kinds of foods happens, is in the colon.
Well, now, David, you wrote that civilizations can fall when the soil is exhausted or eroded. Is it going too far to start to worry now that our species could be threatened if we similarly endanger microbes in our own bodies, say with antibiotics or with chemicals or any other modern thing, even radiation, for example?
Well, you know, I think that it's probably fair to say that in much the same way that sort of the degradation of the soil on the outside environment can endanger the health of civilizations, that the degradation of the inner soil within us in terms of our microbiota and how it's supported can endanger our own individual health. And it certainly raises questions in terms of, like, if we ever get off this planet and engage in sort of like long-distance space travel, we can't go alone. We're bringing a whole bunch of passengers along with us. We've got to figure out how to care for them. And I think the common element here in my mind is that what it really suggests we need to do is to reorient both agricultural and medical practices around trying to cultivate and feed the beneficial microbes that help sustain the fertility of the soil and help sustain the activity of our immune system and the health of our inner soil, the health of our colons, and all those metabolites that the fiber-fermenting bacteria in our colon actually work for us and produce for us. And that's sort of a different way of thinking about those kinds of practices. You know, we're a remarkably clever and remarkably resilient species. I'm personally not terribly worried about us going extinct over any of these issues. I used to be much more worried about essentially what may happen to civilization in terms of the soil. I actually think there's ways, though, to solve these problems, and they're far simpler than I thought like a decade ago in terms of we can have intensive agriculture capable of feeding the world. We just have to do it differently than we do it today. And if we think about the maintenance of what I call the sort of the inner garden in the inner soil of our colon, you know, if we rethink about the nature of what we eat, the sort of the balance of foods that we eat, and so that we're sure that we provide the fiber fermenters in our colons with an adequate diet, then, you know, we can start, I think, turning around both this sort of epidemic of chronic diseases that have started to affect us, as well as try and turn around the long-term societal epidemic of soil degradation that has plagued not only societies through history, but that is a serious problem in the modern world as well. We just have to think differently about these processes and start to work with and cultivate our microbial allies rather than orienting our practices and our chemical uses around trying to take out the pathogens while inadvertently harming our allies.
Do you folks have a web page, a Facebook spot, or a Twitter feed that listeners should know about to follow up?
Yeah, we sure do. Our website is dig2, that's the number 2, grow, dig2grow.com. And then that's also our Twitter handle, which is @dig2grow. And then as far as Facebook goes, we're there under the title of the book, The Hidden Half of Nature.
Listeners, I'll put some links to the new book, the older one, and a couple of YouTube videos in my show blog at ecoshock.info. David R. Montgomery is a professor of geomorphology at the University of Washington, and he's the winner of a $500,000 MacArthur Foundation Genius Award back in 2008. His seminal book, still definitely worth a read, is Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations. Now David and co-author, biologist Ann Bilkay, have released a new book just hitting the stores and Amazon. It's called The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. David and Ann, it's been a pleasure having you on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, yeah. It's been a real blast. Thank you.
Okay. I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Federal Bureau of Investigation is clearly using the Ohio prison system to rig the 2016 presidential election. The FBI is so completely and absolutely terrified of the possibility of a Sean Swain presidency, they have directed prison officials to suspend all of my communications permanently. Everything else is smoke and mirrors. It's all about 2016 and preventing me from becoming president. You can't really blame them, I guess. A federal court has declared me a unique security threat, so it's pretty easy for the FBI to reasonably conclude that I'm the single greatest danger they've ever faced. And if somehow I got elected president, well, that would be the immediate death of civilization. They can't let that happen. No doubt the FBI has gotten together with representatives from the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency, likely in that underground bunker where Dick Cheney still secretly runs the world, and they all came to the same conclusion. Anybody but Swain. And so, the communications ban. Smart move on their part. Consider the political climate and landscape that's developing. In both corporate hierarch political parties, you've got some shakeups. It would appear that the vast majority of this domesticated hierarch population is in the midst of a kind of electoral rebellion, openly rejecting the status quo that's been offered in election cycle after election cycle. It would appear that everyone is disillusioned with the same old candidates and the same old solutions. On the Democratic side, we're seeing a real surge from Bernie Sanders, a guy who is an open and admitted socialist. Yeah, the establishment of the corporate Democratic Party is on the verge of being overtaken by a commie with the popular support of what used to be the Democratic base. Then on the other side, Republicans are supporting non-politicians who are presenting themselves as insurgents in the process to bring about radical changes. You've got Trump and Ben Carson and Carly Fiorina pretty much rounding out the top three. Now, the politics of Sanders, Trump, Carson, and Fiorina aside, the point is that the American electorate is seeking someone to radically transform a system they believe to be broken. Everyone senses that something needs to be done. The system as it is needs to be rejected, and they're all seeking a solution. While the vast majority of deluded hierarch voters may not know exactly what the problem is or know what the solution is, they know the current reality really sucks. And so, given voters' seeming mutiny, it's absolutely essential that the FBI keeps the duct tape across my mouth until the election cycle is over. Just imagine if I was able to procure video, audio, and print media that fully explains the precarious situation that confronts us, or if I could give a fuller, more complete deconstruction of the current systems that reduce all of us to slaves dragging stones up the side of the pyramid. How those who assume the right to rule have hijacked our lives and our future. And how the real solution is a complete rebellion against hierarchy in its entirety, the abolition of the United States. Imagine if I could talk to millions of voters who are down with the throwing the bums out, and I could convince them to throw the bums out forever. Imagine if that message resonated. Voters would come to a kind of consciousness that they are each individually part of a massive, vast, disempowered, alienated population of the swindled and abused. So whether I would really get elected or not, something would remain smoldering and millions, perhaps, would have a sense that the problem is bigger and the solution is more radical than elected politics can address, a growing rage and love and hope. The illegitimacy of the hierarch pathology is one of those things that when you finally see it, you can never unsee it again. So exposing millions of malcontents to a fuller analysis of the vast crime being committed against us and what's at stake would create a situation where there's no talking everyone into returning to their assigned seats. One way or another, civilization would be over. So to save the world, it's necessary to get around these FBI-imposed obstacles. I'm currently finishing up my platform, a detailed plan for how to completely disassemble the United States and the global capitalist system, which would be my goals when elected president. I'm calling my presidential platform Dumpster Fire, the Death of Swivelization in 2016. We need to get my campaign t-shirts in info shops across the country. Want to dance naked around a bonfire where the District of Columbia used to be? Vote for me in 2016. This is anarchist presidential candidate and Ohio governor in exile, Sean Swain, from somewhere inside the Ohio torture complex. And I approve this message. What you say, what you say, what you say, what? I'll call like a bomb! I'm not dead. Well, I'm still alive. This is really awkward. I didn't plan on this. The current suspension of my communications started at the end of August. The fascists simply cut off all my outgoing communications, the equivalent to putting duct tape on my face. This is part of the pattern. Fascists suspended my communications in January to stop me from producing video talking about my innocence in my criminal case. They shut down my communications again in May when I wrote a statement in opposition to the international crime of torture. No good deed goes unpunished. Shortly after my communications resumed, fascists suspended them again with no explanation at all, apparently because they just don't like me. The message being sent is pretty clear. Until I embrace George W. Bush and Jesus, until my thinking conforms to what the ODRC likes, I have to shut up forever. All of this occurred, by the way, while my legal counsel, Richard Kerger, stood on the sidelines with a burger and a beer, spectating. Kerger gave them permission with his inaction. Attorneys are worthless. What do you call 10,000 attorneys buried up to their necks on the beach at low tide? A damn good start. So just to explain, this may seem like a situation that is just a minor annoyance, like being grounded off the phone in high school. But there's also the psychological effect, the constant sense of precarity and anxiety, the knowledge of being under attack in a million small ways, of being totally helpless as repression grinds on and on. And in my situation, it wasn't that communication suspensions would end and I could return to normal. There is a kind of cumulative effect from the suspension after suspension that wears on you. This current suspension began almost immediately after the last one ended, and it didn't just wear on me. It wears on those who care about me. Humans are social animals, after all. My elderly parents, who are very much not anarchists, suffer continuing harm. My dad was throwing up blood and was hospitalized and had not heard from me for months. Just recently, my mom fell and cracked ribs while trying to care for my dad. I have to think that their slow recoveries are due at least in part to not having any communications with their only child for months. Isan, still recovering from the strokes, still needing encouragement and human connection, has also been harmed. Others too. Part of what makes the situation psychologically tortuous is the sense that this will go on forever and ever, that the fascists will just keep silencing me until I agree to stop communicating, until I give up attempting to tell the truth. CIA manuals speak to inflicting this kind of psychological pain in order to diminish a subject's motivational strength. As the CIA describes, such a program of deprivation, quote, induces regression by depriving the subject's mind of contact with an outer world and thus forcing it in on itself, end quote. So, as a consequence, someone in this kind of situation, due to the psychological pain, regresses and becomes less and less able to focus on anything more than the psychological pain and the subject's own situation. As humans, we become neutralized then, not just by the logistical hassle of communication suspensions, but we become unable to focus on anything beyond our own situations, our own psychological pain. In my own situation, that means I'm not only blocked from knowing what's going on in the world and then weighing in on issues, but the immediate psychological pain forces me to focus on nothing else. It sucks. So, all of this taken together, my permanent neutralization, it seems, along with the fact that I'm now being used as a weapon to hurt people I love, got me to thinking about something my grandmother told me. My grandmother feared being unable to care for herself, being put into a home. She often told me that there were worse things than death. And there's nothing worse than outliving yourself. So in the midst of this permanent isolation, where I'm now used to hurt those I love, I drew a reasonable conclusion, I think, that I have outlived me. I decided to forgo my blood pressure meds until my communications resumed. And I also know the ODRC would not resume the communications, so I would have to quit the meds. I've been on them for 10 years, and quitting cold turkey causes a blood pressure spike, which could lead to strokes, aneurysms, heart attacks. So I wrote some really self-important diatribes in the form of legal declarations in order to get them out of the prison, and I quit the meds, knowing the ODRC wouldn't budge. I expected that in about 72 hours, I would fall over dead. All of your savages would read my profound words of great power, and you'd take up your machetes to hack civilization to pieces. You know, in love and rage and all that. Then I didn't die. I quit my meds and finalized all my affairs, and nothing happened. It's been weeks. I've been awaiting my dramatic sputtering out. Not even chest pains. I didn't count on this. It appears I'm going to be around for a while, so I better find something to talk about. This is so embarrassing. For better or for worse, this is still anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from inside the Ohio Torture Complex. If you're listening, you are the resistance. Somebody wrote recently and suggested that I talk about the topic of morality. Okay, don't get mad. To speak of morality is to speak of the ideas of right and wrong, but these ideas of right and wrong in a moral context take on a different meaning than when we talk about right or wrong in a practical sense. To illustrate what I mean, there is a practical and mechanically right way to fix the air pump that causes poison gas to flood the gas chamber at a Nazi concentration camp. That right or correct way to fix the air pump involves a lug wrench. But from a moral perspective, there is the question of whether it is right to fix the air pump at all, or whether it is right to jam the wrench into the machinery. So you see, there's often a practical idea of what is right, which is generally irrelevant to the moral question of what is right. One use of right and wrong corresponds to the idea of correct or incorrect, while the other idea of right and wrong appeals to some concept of moral or immoral. Now, in questions of right and wrong, as applies to morality, what we're really doing is appealing to some generalized or universally accepted maxim. In questions of right and wrong, we seek to conform to an absolute standard of what we ought to do or what we should do that we believe to be universally applicable. That is, when we find a stranger's wallet on the sidewalk, we don't turn it in because it's Tuesday. We turn it in because that's what everyone in the same situation is supposed to do. So for there to be right and wrong, for there to be morality, a universal standard, that universal standard has to be universal. If it isn't, then there's no such thing as right or wrong, no such thing as moral absolutes. Let's think about whether there is a universal standard of right and wrong. If there is a universal standard, what would it include? How about do not kill? That seems an easy place to start. It would seem that if there is a universal standard of right and wrong, do not kill would have to be part of it. But to make it universal, we have to modify it, if just a little. After all, some folks eat meat, and they kill animals to eat meat, and that means our universal standard has to accommodate meat-eating animal killers. So our universal moral standard isn't do not kill, but is instead do not kill humans. There. A universal moral standard. But hold on. There's also the question of self-defense. Reasonably, there's an exception that's generally accepted for killing other humans, and that's when the other human is trying to kill you. So our now universal moral standard is do not kill other humans unless they try to kill you. That works, right? Well, maybe. Except in civilization, where we also have property rights and it's generally accepted that you can defend property by killing someone trying to take it. So let's change our universally moral standard one more time. Here's what we got. Do not kill other humans unless they try to kill you or take your stuff. Sounds good. The problem is, here in civilization, we have universally recognized nation states with borders and standing militaries, and those militaries are universally recognized as legitimate. Our universal morality has to account for that. So here we go. Do not kill other humans unless they try to kill you or take your stuff, or unless you are ordered to kill by your military commander. This is getting cumbersome, isn't it? Maybe to save time, we should just brainstorm all the different possible objections to it so that we can make our universal maxim really universal. So we have to accommodate age-old religions and the people who follow them. That means we have to make exceptions to our do-not-kill standard for adultery. The Mosaic Law requires death by stoning for unruly children. We have to make exceptions for domestic law enforcement, too. We have to. If we don't, our universal standard isn't universal, and that means these ideas of right and wrong are just subjective and provincial. So for us to formulate what the universal standard is in something as fundamental as value of life, let's see what we end up with once we get it down to something no one can object to. Do not kill other humans unless they try to kill you or take your stuff, or unless you're ordered to kill by your military commander, or except in the case of adultery or unruly children, or worshipping false idols, or unless you are involved in domestic law enforcement, or you're a security guard for a gated community, and in the course of the function of your job as law enforcement or security guard, you encounter someone black who steals a cigar or sells a cigarette single or wears a hoodie and eats Skittles. I don't know about you, but I'm exhausted. I think I'm ready to conclude that in even something as fundamental as valuing life, there's no universal moral standard of right and wrong. And if there's no universal moral standard for something as fundamental as that, then maybe there's no universal moral standard for anything. So what value is this idea of morality? I guess we'll talk about that next time. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from somewhere inside the Ohio torture complex. If you're listening, you are the resistance. You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Carolyn Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, who talks about what's at stake for labor unions and all workers as the Supreme Court hears arguments in the Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association case. Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, who explains why he believes New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's new pardon program for youthful offenders can open doors for thousands in the state. And Kim Ives of the international weekly newspaper Haiti Liberté, who discusses the widespread charges of fraud linked to the cancellation of Haiti's scheduled second round presidential election. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a year-long investigation, the Guardian newspaper found that 1,134 young black men were killed by police officers across the U.S. in 2015. Deadly incidents with the police were researched in every state, with New Mexico found to have the highest per capita rate of deadly run-ins with the police. While young black men only make up 2% of the U.S. population, they accounted for 15% of all cases of police use of deadly force. The overall rate of police-involved deaths is 5 times higher for blacks than for white men. The greater visibility of recent cases of police shootings of black men, increased numbers of officers have faced criminal charges. But prosecution is difficult, as illustrated in the mistrial verdict in the Freddie Gray case in Baltimore. 25% of African Americans killed by police were unarmed, compared to 17% of whites killed. The U.S. Department of Justice is testing a new, comprehensive database on police killings, based on the data developed by The Guardian. The FBI has already announced plans to overhaul their reporting system of police homicides, which is currently based on voluntary submissions by local police departments. On December the 28th, Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe apologized to South Korea for abuses against comfort women who were forced to serve as sex workers in Japanese military brothels during World War II. The Japanese government agreed to pay $8.3 million to care for the 46 surviving comfort women. For years, the injustices committed against the comfort women had damaged Japan-South Korea relations. 50 years after the two Asian nations had renewed diplomatic relations, Japan's Prime Minister Abe met with South Korean President Park Geun-hye in November to get settlement talks moving. Yet many of the remaining comfort women and their advocates remain opposed to the agreement, stating that they, the victims, should be offered direct official government compensation. Japan first recognized the injustices done to the South Korean comfort women in 1993, with an apology from then Chief Cabinet Secretary Yohei Kono, saying the women were coerced, but put some of the blame on Japanese military contractors. Now, comfort women from other Japanese-occupied Asian nations, such as China, Taiwan, and the Philippines, are demanding compensation for surviving victims of sexual slavery. What started out as a land reclamation project in Lagos, Nigeria, is turning into a massive private insta-city destined to be the playground for wealthy Nigerians with high-priced condos isolated from the nation's poverty and sprawling slums. The new city within a megacity is known as Eco Atlantic, with boosters that include Bill Clinton and former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. But a growing number of critics say that the luxury development comes at the expense of critical investment in Lagos' basic infrastructure, like electricity and water services. According to the Christian Science Monitor, cities in sub-Saharan Africa are growing twice as fast as cities globally, yet 70% of Africa's urban residents live in informal slums with little access to basic sanitation. The $6 billion Eco Atlantic, being built with the backing of a Lebanese-Nigerian development company, is set to build a new international school for wealthy residents, moorings for luxury yachts, and a modern hospital. The new insta-city also plans to go off-grid to avoid Lagos' chronic electricity shortages. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
For almost 40 years, the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized the right of public sector labor unions to collect union dues from non-members that they represent as they negotiate with management on the issues of job site working conditions that benefit the entire workforce. But in the case known as Friedrichs v. California Teachers Association, which will be argued before the High Court on January 11th, a group of non-union California teachers are litigating to prevent unions from collecting all fees related to collective bargaining, contract administration, and the handling of employee grievances. The plaintiffs, supported by the right-wing Center for Individual Rights that receives funding from the Koch brothers, maintain that all spending by the union is inherently political, and mandatory employee contributions to it thus constitute compelled speech, which is generally prohibited by the First Amendment. The plaintiffs' attorneys argue that the Supreme Court should overturn its ruling in the 1977 Abood v. Detroit Board of Education case that concluded that fair share fees preventing free rides by non-union members was constitutional. Your reporter spoke with Carolyn Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, who discusses her group's work in alerting the public to the critical issues at stake for labor unions and all workers in the Friedrichs v. California Teachers Association case.
The basic issue that's at stake is a First Amendment challenge, a free speech challenge to laws that affect the employee speech rights of public employees. The lawsuit is against the union, California Teachers Association. The dissident teachers are saying that they should not have to pay any fee to the union to cover the costs of the collective bargaining process. They're not paying any fee for political activities or anything aside from the very limited issue of the cost of getting them a higher wage. This arrangement, this fair share arrangement, has been the law for decades, has been affirmed by the Supreme Court in many, many cases. And what is at stake now is that these plaintiffs, the Friedrichs plaintiffs, are trying to argue that there should be no such arrangement allowable, and thus that they should be able to get the benefit of any collective bargaining agreement, get the higher wages and benefits, and not have to pay any fee. So it's basically the free rider rights approach. And I would just say, so that the listeners understand, it's actually the law in this country that unions have to represent everybody fairly in the bargaining unit. So they can't say, all right, we're only going to represent those workers who are our members. They have to represent everybody who is doing that job and in that bargaining unit, regardless of whether they're a union member or not. So essentially, this gets at the very ability of unions to be able to represent and fight for the rights of workers. It's brought by a group of people who are represented by some very right-wing foundations that are funded by the Koch brothers. This is part and parcel of the effort of dismantling a progressive America. So this is about trying to destroy the public employee unions and ultimately destroy the private sector unions, and that will follow. But again, it's a case that's completely unprecedented. There's longstanding case law affirming this arrangement, and the school districts and the states really like it. It's a good arrangement for them. It gives them labor peace, and it gives them a good way of interacting with their employees.
Caroline, when it comes to public service workers, folks like teachers, nurses, social workers, and firefighters, what's at stake for them in this case? What would happen to public service unions if the Supreme Court justices uphold the plaintiff's case here?
Well, I mean, we have a really good set of facts to evaluate that with, because we have what are unfortunately called right-to-work laws, but are actually kind of the opposite, right to be paid less is more like it. And what happens when there's a right-to-work law adopted in a state is that immediately the public sector unions lose a very large number of members because, again, you know, it's understandable. And an individual person who says, wow, I could pay for this work that gets done that gives me a higher wage, or I could get my higher wage for free and not pay in. But when too many people do that, then the unions cannot actually engage in the work to get the better wages, to get the better benefits, and it is really destructive of the whole strength of the labor movement. You know, what's so interesting is that there's a kind of a perverse argument here on the right about this free speech rights of the employees, and that is, if you recognize that every single thing that a public employee says is entitled to free speech rights, then you've created a really powerful element in the public sector of workers who can basically say anything anytime they want in a way that is so unusual. In fact, it doesn't exist in any other workplace. It's one of the reasons why there is certainly some hope that some of the conservative justices would not agree with Justice Alito, because it has a perverse impact on the ability of governments to treat their employees, like any other employer, in the sense of not constitutionalizing everything that the employee says.
Would the net effect be the bankruptcy of some of these public service employees unions? Would that be what would happen if enough employees opted out of paying their union dues, the whole system could collapse? Is that the idea here?
Well, you know, in a kind of, maybe not an absolute sense of bankruptcy, but certainly metaphorically, it would certainly be very hard for many of them to operate. And you'd certainly see some of them no longer able to function, but they'd be weak. In any case, they'd be very weak, and the weaker they would be in their ability to get workers higher wages, the less workers would support them, and the weaker they would become. And so, you know, I think it's a very dangerous spiral downwards for workers, because the weaker the unions get, the less leverage the workers have to get better wages, to get better benefits. And I would also say the thing that's really important to remember about public sector unions is that the public sector unions have achieved in our economy the best record in terms of narrowing the wage gap between women and men and between minorities and white people. And that's because it's been part of their mission is to get fair wages and benefits and to eliminate discrimination. And so it's a sector where women and minorities have really achieved more than they have in the rest of the economy, and that is also at stake to the extent that public sector unions are weakened.
That was Carolyn Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society. For more perspectives on the Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association case, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In late December, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced a plan to pardon thousands of people who were convicted of nonviolent crimes as teenagers, but have since turned their lives around. New York is one of just two states that still prosecutes 16- and 17-year-olds as adults in the criminal justice system, resulting in thousands of teens receiving felony convictions that places obstacles in the way of accessing education and or securing jobs and housing. Under New York's program, individuals who committed a crime while they were 16 or 17, have not been convicted of any crime for at least 10 years, who are not sex offenders, and are not in arrears on their taxes, may apply for and be almost guaranteed a pardon. The program, however, does not erase the felony conviction, but rather provides a certificate of rehabilitation that explains that the individual has met all the state's requirements and is in good standing in the eyes of the state of New York. Governor Cuomo maintains that his plan will be a reward for good behavior and provide citizens a second chance, acknowledging that when young people make a mistake, they shouldn't have to carry that burden the rest of their lives. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, who explains why he believes this is an important effort that can improve the lives of thousands of New Yorkers.
Well, what we're seeing from Governor Cuomo is really the first time that any sitting governor is doing an across-the-board pardon for people who've gotten in trouble with the law at a young age. So the proposal would recognize that many young people have made mistakes, but they've since gone on to lead productive lives, and yet they're still hampered in terms of the felony conviction they got at a very young age, and this has an effect on their prospects for employment, housing, other types of benefits of society. What the governor's action is doing is a recognition first that New York is one of only two states that try all 16 and 17-year-olds as adults. And so the likelihood that young people get an adult felony conviction is obviously much greater than it is in other states. So it's a recognition that New York is out of line in this regard, but it's also a recognition that 16, 17-year-olds and even older young people do make mistakes, but they grow out of those mistakes. And so there's really no reason why this type of proposal couldn't be applied to 18, 19, 20-year-olds as well in most states around the country.
I wasn't sure how big a deal this is because this action will not take away these individuals' felony convictions, right?
What the governor's proposal would do is it doesn't delete the felony conviction from a record, but essentially gives qualifying people a certificate of rehabilitation. So they go and apply for a job, they go and apply to live in public housing, whatever it may be, and they have to answer, yes, I do have a felony conviction, if they're asked. But at the same time, they've got a letter from the state of New York that says they met all the requirements, and essentially they've received a pardon for their behavior. So it's a way to let everyone know what the history is, but also let relevant parties know that this person, in the eyes of the state of New York, you know, has redeemed himself or herself and should be treated as any other citizen would for these purposes.
Mark Maurer, what kind of numbers are we talking about of people who could benefit from this?
The state's estimate is that there may be as many as 10,000 people who could benefit from this policy. This goes back many years. Someone might have had a felony conviction as a 16-year-old in 1970. Now they're 60 years old or something in that range. And felony conviction carries with you for the rest of your life. So the 10,000 people, you know, span a broad range of ages, and in many cases we know that the conviction has continued to hurt them even many years after it took place.
Can Governor Cuomo do this on his own and not have to go through the legislature?
Well, the governor has the authority to do this on his own as the governor. Separately, there's been a movement in New York for a number of years now to try to raise the age of jurisdiction to 18 for trial in adult criminal court. That has not been successful to date. So I think it's a sort of two-pronged strategy. The governor is recognizing the harm that's come in recent decades. And moving forward from here, I think there's some reason to believe that New York, before too long, may join with other states in raising the age to 18 so that actions like this from the governor would not be necessary.
For a long time, Connecticut was the third state, besides New York and North Carolina, that treated 16 and 17-year-olds as adults in the criminal justice system. Connecticut raised the age to 18 a few years ago. And now Governor Daniel Malloy wants to raise the age to 21 to be considered a juvenile offender. Can I assume you would also be in favor of that?
That would be, yeah. And, you know, it's very much in keeping with, you know, what we've seen, you know, the research in brain science, you know, the recognition by courts that, you know, young people's brains aren't fully mature until they're 24, 25. So we do need to treat them differently. And there's growing recognition about that these days.
That was Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project. For more information on this New York State initiative and other developments in juvenile justice reform, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For a period of 4 years since 2010, local and legislative elections were postponed in Haiti under the administration of President Michel Martelly. This set up a situation where Martelly, whose government has been charged with pervasive corruption, has ruled by decree since January 2015. When the first round of legislative elections were held on August 9th last year, they were disrupted by violence. And when Haitians went to the polls again on October 25th last year to choose a successor to Martelly and participate in the second round of elections to pick new legislators, opposition parties charged that the process was marked by widespread fraud. Those charges were recently confirmed in a report issued by an independent panel. In the October 25th election, Martelly's hand-picked candidate, Jovenel Moïse, a political unknown, won 32.8% of the vote, with opposition candidate Jude Celestin winning 25.3% of votes cast. A second-round presidential election originally scheduled for December 27th was subsequently postponed until January 17th. But on January 5th, the head of Haiti's Provisional Electoral Council stated it was impossible to organize a presidential runoff in time to meet a February 7th constitutional deadline for the handover of power from one elected president to another. Adding to an already chaotic political environment, an alliance of 8 opposition presidential candidates has demanded the resignation of the Provisional Electoral Council and the creation of a provisional government to complete the election process. Your reporter spoke with journalist Kim Ives, co-founder and an editor with the international weekly newspaper Haiti Liberté. Here he assesses the current political situation in Haiti, with analysis of Washington's agenda and role in the process.
The president, the Senate, and the deputies, as well as all the municipal posts, are being elected in this sort of rolling election. So there were 3 rounds scheduled, August 9th, October 25th, and December 27th. And August 9th was a disaster, not just for the fraud, but for the violence. Basically, the parties sympathetic to Martelly stood at the voting bureau doors with their arms crossed and wouldn't let anybody else in. There were only poll watchers for the official parties of the government. Hence, a lot of people got beat up. A lot of ballots were destroyed. It was a complete disaster. the U.S. and I could say the European Union generally said, well, you know, it's Haiti. We have to keep marching forward, and the next round on October 25th will be better. Well, the October 25th round was better in terms of violence. There was not the same degree of violence, even though there was some, but not as much. But the fraud was outrageous, and Martelly's presidential candidate, an unknown banana exporter, Jovenel Moïse, came in first place with about 34% of the vote. Everybody was shocked. How could this be? The guy was an unknown, and he beat out the two Lavalas currants, came in third and fourth place. And these were one headed by Maurice Narcisse, who represents the current of former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. She came in fourth, and then a sort of a breakaway Lavalas current, who was a little more radical, headed by a former senator called Moïse Jean-Charles, came in third. Jovenel Moïse came in first. The second place went to Jude Celestin, who came in second place back in 2010. And he is not officially with Préval, but in fact, behind the scenes, it is Préval that is behind him. So we're now going to see what happens because of all the outcry by not just Haitian observers, but even some international observers, and all of the what they call the political class in Haiti. They had essentially walked back the December 27th election, which now is set for January 17th. The only problem is that Jude Celestin, after the October 25th election, he said that was a ridiculous farce and that he would not be part of any ongoing runoff with Jovenel Moïse. And he blocked with a group of seven other of the leading presidential runners-up in a group called the G8, the Group of Eight. So the G8 was, you know, very strongly opposed to going forward with Jovenel. They said he had to be kicked out. The independent commission had to go and look into it. Well, an independent commission never happened, but a Martelly-appointed commission came in, and they handed down their decision. And they said, yes, there were tons of problems with the election. There were irregularities right and left, but we got to go forward with the vote anyway, and everybody was involved in the fraud, and therefore it wouldn't have really changed the results, so we're going to go forward with Moïse Jovenel and Jude Celestin. So all eyes now, Scott, are on Jude Celestin. Is he going to walk back his declaration and take part in this second round, which he wants to do? We know that from sources behind the scene and in his campaign, but he just hasn't found the face-saving way to do so without incurring the wrath not only of the other opposition candidates, but also of the Haitian people.
I would imagine one of the major issues for Jude Celestin and other political players in Haiti is whether this now rescheduled runoff presidential election is going to be organized in a fair fashion or not. And what if any new elements are being put in place in order to guarantee that the fraud will be kept to a bare minimum?
The January 17th date is not even really official. It's been announced by Martelly, but the Martelly-appointed commission, not an independent one, but the Martelly-appointed review commission, essentially said there should be some changes in the Provisional Electoral Council. Our analysis here at Haiti Liberté is that essentially what the U.S. is trying to do in Haiti is establish a system similar to here, where you have a single party with two heads, Republican, Democrat. You know, you alternate between the two and nothing much else changes. And in a way, that's what they'd like to see in Haiti, where the Martelly group, these neo-Duvalierist right-wingers, would be the Republican surrogate. And then the Préval group, which is a more liberal version, but equally willing to work with the U.S., would be the Democrats. And we suspect that Washington would prefer to see the Celestin / Préval crew in power, because the Martelly group has been so corrupt. They're so unpopular now. They are so repressive, and they're just embarrassing the U.S. because they have to stand by them and say, you know, the process must go on. But, you know, they really would rather be done with Martelly, for the time being at least.
That was journalist Kim Ives, co-founder and an editor with the international weekly newspaper Haiti Liberté. Find more analysis of Haiti's current political situation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Medications for the money, not patients. In the last 2 years or so, there's been a revolution in the treatment of hepatitis C. Don't be scared. The word hepatitis means inflammation of the liver. Since 2013, two drugs have come on the market which boast of cure rates of between 95 to 99%. For many hepatitis sufferers, this seems like a medical miracle, for cures are actually quite rare in medicine, and most diseases are managed by lifelong units of medications. But in 2013 and 2014, two drugs were cleared by the FDA for hepatitis cures, Sovaldi and Harvoni. But despite these drugs, the prices offered by drug companies had made them unavailable to most of the people who need them. The cost? $1,000. A pill. I said $1,000. A pill. Sovaldi costs $84,000 for a course of treatment. Harvoni? $94,500. A recent report from the Senate Finance Committee determined that the pharmaceutical company Gilead Sciences Incorporated, which actually acquired the drug from another company, set these prices to maximize profits, knowing it would price out tens of thousands, perhaps millions of potential patients. Conversely, a lower price would have made these life-saving drugs available to more patients. The company that actually developed the drug recommended a course price of $36,000. Gilead, more than double the price. Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat, Oregon, a committee member said, The evidence shows the company pursued a calculated scheme for pricing and marketing its hepatitis C drug based on one primary goal, maximizing profit, regardless of the human consequences. The business of medicine, at war with the meaning of medicine. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Memory for hours now, ever since I heard of her shocking passing. How many hours had I enjoyed her playful, enchanting, enthralling alto contralto, her soprano peaks? Countless. How many times had I stared at her photos, emblazoned on album covers, a beaming smile in a pecan-colored face, caught in a moment of sun-touched beauty, her eyes ablaze like a laughing lioness. Natalie Cole. Unforgettable. That's what you are. Unforgettable. Yes.
Unforgettable. Though near or far. Like a song of love that clings to me.
But also unbelievable. When she, the daughter of the dazzling dark crooner Nat King Cole, was able to sing a duet with her long-dead father, a thing of magic and beauty was born. Daughter and father joined across time. Unforgettable. It won her a Grammy in 2008, but more importantly, it won the hearts of millions to hear the two united in song. This will be in our love for some of her other hits. Natalie Cole suffered for years from hepatitis C and its side effects. She even had a liver transplant. Her voice will now, like her father's, echo through time. Natalie Cole, unforgettable still, joins her ancestors after 65 winters in America. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Against white men. Several days ago, while viewing the weekly Sunday CNN show hosted by Fareed Zakaria, I saw a segment documenting the rising death tolls of white men, especially between the ages of 45 and 54 years. The causes were various: drug overdoses, car accidents, alcoholism, and suicides. Of course, some of the other causes, such as drugs or even car accidents, are actually hidden suicides sometimes. All other groups showed declines. I found it intriguing, especially when class and education were factored in, working class and high school diplomas or less. I've since read half a dozen articles, some scientific, others journalistic, from a variety of publications, many speculating, as big a variety of speculations on causes: failing health, low wages, fear of a changing, browning America, etc. Yet none of these articles touched on what initially came to mind. I'll call it the NAFTA effect for the North American Free Trade Agreement, which sent millions of manufacturing jobs across the border and U.S. businesses in search of cheaper labor. For me, this reason seemed obvious, especially since NAFTA was so widely known, for it affected jobs on both sides of the border, forcing wages lower and lower. An owner, for example, faced with union demands for higher wages, might easily threaten to go overseas to frighten labor leaders into concessions, even givebacks. NAFTA, the gift of Clinton I, was an executive betrayal of labor who fought for and funded the presidential campaign of William Jefferson Clinton. He betrayed them by making a sweet deal with the business class. It ain't the only factor, but I'm convinced it is a factor. Americans, once again, voting for their own betrayers. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. That's right, 2016. Damn. Y'all getting old. Not me, y'all getting old. Anyway, Happy New Year, folks. It seems we can say that, even though it's wishes for the new year, wishes for things to be better, but wishes, if wishes were horses, beggars would ride. That's what my grandmother used to tell me, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to a segment from the dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And that dialogue was called Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a historic dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. This dialogue was held in Riverside Church. It was to a packed crowd. It was in November of 2014. And you can see the entire film of this event online at revcom.us. But in particular, what we're going to be listening to is a segment called Why Are We Still Fighting for Justice in 2015? And I think that's extremely important as we enter into the new year, 2016, and we are still fighting for justice. And opening the show up, we're going to be listening to an interview I did earlier with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we'll be talking with Carl about recent events, recent outrages, the cover-up of the murder of Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old black child shot to death by a cop while playing in a park in Cleveland, and the outrageous fact that the grand jury refused to indict the cops that murdered Tamir Rice. And we'll also be talking about the recent murders of Quintonio LeGreer and Betty Jones in Chicago when Quintonio's family called 911 for help for their son and ended up having to watch a cop murder him. So now let's get into the conversation with Carl Dix. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show a man that I always enjoy talking to because he always talks exactly what needs to be said. There you go, all right? And he's not afraid to actually stand up and tell the truth and to challenge people. And his name is Carl Dix. He's from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. He's also one of the main people that called for Rise Up October. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Sure, sure. We're going to have to set a slot aside for you to be on all the time, man. There's a whole lot to talk about, and I want to carry this as far as we can today because it's really – there's just so much going on, and especially the fact that January 1st, and I'm sitting at my desk last night. And this will give you an idea. I hesitate to say this because everybody else is out partying last night. I'm sitting at my desk, and I'm getting ready for this show, and I decide, okay, I'm going to go to the site Killed by Police. And I went, and at exactly midnight, the toll for the number of people killed by the police in the United States – was 1,199 people, a whole new record. It's almost 100 more than what they tallied for last year, and it's just about 500 more than what they had the year before that. It never stops, Carl. It never stops, man. And I want to talk with you about that. But first, I want to dig into this thing, the most recent outrages, Tamir Rice, and then what's happened in Chicago. Let's talk about Tamir Rice and what happened there first. What's your take on that?
Well, look, the refusal to indict the cops who murdered Tamir Rice is an underscoring of something that I said a little while earlier, several times around the string of killings. And that is that it's a message, a declaration to black people that they have no rights that this white supremacist system is bound to respect. It's a restatement, an updating of the Dred Scott decision from the Supreme Court back in 1857, which said black people had no rights that white people were bound to respect. That is what's being carried out in practice with these police gunning down, choking to death, tasering to death, all kinds of people, but disproportionately black people, and then the criminal injustice system going into operation to get the killer cops off. That is what this comes down to. And it's got to stop, and it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to stop it. That's
all right. I'm going to get into that with you towards the back end.
I know we're going to get into it, but I had to say it.
Okay. All right. That's cool. But I want to make sure, because I'm trying to build up to something here, because there's a lot of stuff that I think, as I was sitting there preparing for this, things kept batting me in the head. You know, I kept thinking about one thing. I know we've talked about this before, too. You know, you see the county prosecutor in Cleveland where he says, ethically, he knew that there could not have been a trial of the cops, so he basically had to go in and tell the grand jury, no way you're going to be able to put these people on trial. You can't convict them of anything. There's really no discernible crime here. You know, this is something when you talk about, we had spoken about, and I think this is going to, the theme will continue to run through this discussion between us. We had talked about the last time you were on the show about the legitimacy and the whole question of legitimacy coming up. And here you have this county prosecutor who not only you know, has done, he's actually worked overtime to actually – you couldn't get a better defense attorney than the county prosecutor.
Yeah, that's exactly it. He played the role of the defense attorney for these cops. The authorities felt like, well, we can't just say let them walk. We have to drag this out. We have to take it through the process. So they put together a grand jury. He went out and got experts to deliver reports to the grand jury, saying that these cops acted reasonably. He released the reports from these experts publicly to create public opinion for exonerating the cops. Then he lets the cops come in and testify, give statements, actually, and does not ask any questions of them. It was being set up to exonerate these cops. That was what he saw as his role. And then you look at it. Less than 2 seconds, they roll up on a 12-year-old boy with a toy gun in a park and gun him down. And this is in a state where it's legal to carry real guns. So, I mean, even if he had a real gun, he wasn't breaking any laws. But they roll up on him and kill him in less than 2 seconds. And that is not criminal. That is the system giving you a loud declaration that your life does not matter, and that if we determine that we have to unleash our cops to brutalize and even murder you in order to keep the setup in effect and functioning as we want it, that's what it's going to be. And that is what's being put forward to us as what is legitimate. And people need to say, hell no, this is unacceptable, it's illegitimate, and then they need to act on that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, I keep thinking, too, when I was back in New York during Rise Up October and had you and Nick Hayward on my show, and we were talking about, this was right after the prosecutor had actually gone out and hired those two pro-police experts and brought them into the grand jury and said, here, these are the people, and knowing that they were going to testify and say straight up, well, the police did nothing wrong. This was normal procedure. This is what they had to do. They did everything correct. You know, and this is the prosecutor, again, acting as the defense. And you think about this in the face of this, even. That's this one up against in the face of that judge that had said earlier on in the case that, in fact, there was reason to hold these people on homicide charges. You know, this is very heavy. It's just a slap in the face that this is the way it's going to go. And it seems to me that it's related to all these other things we're going to be talking about, because it's actually saying, look, there's one thing, yes, it's all what you've said. And then there's the portrayal. I mean, I get so damn angry, too, about the constant references to, well, this was no small boy. This was a large guy. This was a guy that weighed 175 pounds, and he wore size 36 pants. And you're like, what? What the hell are you talking about? And you think about – but then you get that sense of, what are they creating there? What's the image they're creating? They're creating this monster that represents an entire nationality of people for whom it's right. Like what you've been saying, it's right. It's okay to kill. In fact, you have to kill them.
Yes, a black male is a threat, a legitimate target. And when we take them out, no matter how horrific the circumstances, well, he was a threat. And this takes you back to black mothers used to worry about their boys, especially if they were large, if they had large hands, because they knew that that could be a problem. And in the days of Jim Crow segregation and lynch mob terror, you feared that it would be the Ku Klux Klan or a mob of whites who would target your large black child. But today, it's the police targeting them and even bringing into court, well, he was big for his age. So we were legitimate in thinking that this was a threat that had to be dealt with in the way that we did. And then they even use things like the situation developed so quickly that the police had no choice to shoot. See, and that's just a loadable, because the only reason the situation developed quickly is because they charged into the park and rode straight up on Tamir. That's what developed the situation quickly, and shot as they got out of the car. The cop was shooting as he got out of the car.
Let's move on to this thing in Chicago, Carl. This was another mind blower. You know, you wake up and all of a sudden there's one young man blown away by the police, and it was in his house, right? It was in his house that he was blown away. And a woman who opened the door for the cops is also hit and killed. You know, let's talk about this.
Yeah,
one.
And see, this is like, I mean, it also illegitimate and unacceptable, because this young man, Quintonio LeGriere, his family calls 911 because they wanted help. There was a family fight. They thought Quintonio was having some trouble, and they wanted somebody to help them calm this situation down. The police show up, and they show up and start shooting. They blow away Quintonio. And then Betty Jones is a neighbor who was in her house and who opened the door when it was knocked on, and she was killed by police too. Two families, like the morning after Christmas, they're not opening presents, looking at it, reveling in the, you know, enjoying the family gatherings. They are burying loved ones who have been gunned down by killer cops. And see, this is in a Chicago where there is already a crisis of legitimacy around the way police have been brutalizing and murdering people, and especially murdering black people, because of the release of the video of young brother McDonald, Laquan McDonald, where the cops had said he charged at them, and the video showed that they had lied, falsified reports, and apparently had erased videos of from the fast food places around there that showed this. But there was still a police video which they held, they sat on for a year, that finally got brought out. So there was already an uproar over the way the police were killing people and getting away with it. And then you have this happen on top of that. And it basically says to you that either they can't stop their police from going into black and other oppressed communities like they're an occupying army and wantonly murdering people, or they don't want to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You know, Carl, it's very heavy, because when you were talking about this, and I was thinking about this, I read a few things last night that were really just mind-blowing. And one of the things was in Chicago, they keep talking about, all right, they're going to resolve it. They're going to solve the problem. They got, you know, Rahm Emanuel. He knows he's come back from Cuba. He's so dedicated. He came back from his vacation, and he's going to tell you, he's going to be out there, and he's going to tell you he's going to solve it. And then they put forward what the solution is. And it really struck me last night. I read there was an article in The Guardian that said their solution is tasers. And tasers as if they were sort of like throwing a meringue pie at somebody. You know, tasers can be very deadly and extremely painful. People have died from being tased. This is like sometimes 50,000 volts of electricity going into your body.
Yeah, it's like it is 50,000 volts. That's what this is. You're getting shocked with 50,000 volts. A number of people have been killed by being tased. Natasha McKinney is one. There was a man in Pennsylvania who was recently tased to death by cops. So this is not a non-lethal, more kid gloves approach. This is like, well, we're going to arm police with another way to torture you, to brutalize you, and maybe murder you as the solution. People are also raising things like, well, we need better training for the police. The problem is that police play a certain role in society. I mean, we're talking about a situation where this system has no future for like millions and millions of young black people, young Latino people growing up in the inner cities across this country. It's the very operation of this system that has taken away jobs and other legitimate means to survive and raise families. And there is no attempt to, well, let's retool the economy to create space for these people who are being kicked out of it as we move our factories halfway around the world in search of workers that we can exploit even more savagely. No attention to, well, let's come with some job training so that we can fit these people into other sectors of the economy. No, it's let's unleash the police. Let's create laws that target people in the inner cities. Let's apply those laws in disproportionate ways, and let's have prisons to put them in. That's the program for these youth that are out there, and the police are the front lines of it, and they don't want to pull back on them. The problem isn't, well, let's, you know, give them better tools, let's give them better training. That's why I say we need a new system. Mm-hmm. We need a revolution to get rid of this once and for all.
Exactly. Now, we're going to get into, I promise you, we're going to get into that heavy and hard. All right. But first, I want to let people know that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're talking about, once again, that's something we're going to keep on talking about, and that hopefully people will be doing more than just talking about this. It's important to talk about it. It's important to declare what side you're on, but it's important to take action around this too, for a lot of people to stand up and say this cannot be allowed to continue. Now, Carl, I read an article last night that was Ta-Nehisi Coates, yes, in The Atlantic. He wrote this recent piece, and he talked about how America has decided that it is permissible, that it is wise, that it is moral for the police to de-escalate through killing, which he then goes on to link directly to the question of legitimacy. And he says that a state that allows its agents to beat, to kill, to tase without any real sanctions has ceased to govern and has commenced to simply rule, which essentially is saying, look, we're just going to keep on doing what we're doing. And he's basically saying that the state is saying, this is all we can do. This is what we have decided is the way to go. And then he says that that calls into question the entire concept of the state that you're living in, the character of the state. Legitimacy becomes the big issue.
Yeah, see, and this is a real question, because I was watching the trial of the cop in Baltimore, the first of the six cops in Baltimore who are going on trial for the murder of Freddie Gray. And there's a whole lot to say about this, including this question of prosecutors forgetting how to prosecute. But one thing that really struck me is that after this cop got let off, the discussion about that from all quarters, from these talking heads that were on TV, was, well, of course we have to give the police the benefit of the doubt when their actions are being questioned. And it is kind of like, why? Why should trained law enforcement personnel get the benefit of the doubt when they murder a teenager, or when they murder a grandmother like Betty Jones in Chicago, or when they kill a 12-year-old like Tamir Rice in Cleveland? See, and what this comes down to is, well, because they are the frontline enforcers for the state, you have to accept their actions as being legitimate. That's how you have to go at it. You have to go at it that, well, of course, they wouldn't just vamp down and crush people, because they're the ones who are protecting and serving, right? And see, that's not the case. And what it does come down to is what police protect and serve are not the people, but the system that's ruling over the people. And what's happening through this endless wave of murders and the exoneration of the killer cops is that people are more and more beginning to call into question the actions of the police. And even though it's mostly not seen this way by the people, like people are flowing into the streets in Chicago. They're calling for the resignation of Rahm Emanuel and other figures. And they're not necessarily seeing it this way, but objectively what they're fighting over is this question of the legitimacy of the system's use of force against the people. That's what's being called into question here through the actions of people demanding the resignation of all these officials. And that is something that people need to come to recognize that's up for issue here. Are the actions of these enforcers for the state and the whole system that backs them up illegitimate. I mean, they are. People need to begin to see that. And that's something that Bob Avakian has stressed in the kind of work that revolutionaries need to be doing. Because it's not enough. I've said a couple times, it's going to take revolution, nothing less. But it's not enough to just talk about revolution. You have to actually develop a plan and a strategy for that. You have to bring forward a vision of the kind of world that could be brought into being through revolution and show how that could deal with not only this horror that we're talking about today, the way the police get away with murder, but all of the horrors, the attacks on women, the way that immigrants are being deported in massive numbers, pushed to the side, pushed to the margins of society and treated like less than human beings, the wars for empire. And Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, has done that. He's led in developing a plan for how you could get from here to the point where it would be possible to lead people in going for revolution with a real chance of victory. He's brought forward a vision of the kind of world that could be brought forward through revolution and developed a strategy even for making revolution, how it would have to go down in a country like this. And he's done that through the re-envisioning of revolution and communism that he's put decades of work in. And this is something that people need to know about, because we got to be doing two things. Those of us who want to see an end to these horrors got to be doing two things. One is that we have to expose the illegitimacy of the current order and all that it does to people. But we also have to bring forward an alternative legitimacy, another way that the world could be, an understanding for how to bring that world into being and the leadership for it. And that's like, if there's a New Year's resolution that I have to make, it is got to be bringing forward that alternate legitimacy, bringing to people the leadership of Bob Avakian and the revolution that he concentrates, but also the vision of the kind of world we could bring forward through revolution. Because we should not live in a world where people have to talk with their children about what they should do and not do if they have an encounter with a police officer who's supposed to be a trained law enforcement personnel. People who are entrusted with public security should be people who are willing to sooner lose their own lives than kill or injure an innocent person. But this is a society that gives its enforcers the benefit of the doubt when they murder people in the streets, gunning them down, choking them, however.
So how would it be different in the society you're talking about, Carl?
I missed your question. I was talking over you.
Okay. How would it be different in the society you're talking about? Because there's a point about, actually, people got to know that you're actually talking about, as you said, a real revolution. You're not talking about people talking about a revolution. You're talking about there actually has to be an actual revolution. And then what would the society, how would it be different? How would policing be different in your society? Would it just be, a lot of people might get cynical and say, well, you're talking about now your cops are going to just come out and they're going to suppress the people they don't like. How would it be different, man?
Okay, you've raised a very big question.
We got time.
I'm going to speak to it. I know I got time. I'm going to speak to it, but I'm also going to direct people where they could get an even fuller answer.
Okay.
And that is to the Constitution for a Future Socialist Republic in North America, which they can find by going on the website revcom.us, that talks about what the society would be like, how it would be organized, how the government would function, how the legal system would function, what are the rights of the people, how would education be done, all of that. People need to go and check that out. Now, in terms of how would policing be different, here's the first thing. We would get rid of this system and its economic relations, the savage exploitation of people, the glaring inequality between the haves and the have-nots, and everything else, and bring into being a totally different system with different economic relations, a different political system, and one that was in transition to a full communist world, a classless society where there's not differences between the classes of the people, those who have and those who have not. There's not one grouping of people, white people lording it over black people and other oppressed nationalities, men dominating and suppressing women. All of that and the ideas that bring it, hold it all together, would be no more. And I spoke about this thing that those entrusted with public security would be people who would sooner lose their own lives than kill or injure an innocent person. And that's not a pipe dream. That is actually something you can do if your system is not set up to protect a monopoly on wealth and power in the hands of a minority of society, but it's a society where the ways in which to produce everything that people need are collectively owned. They're the common property of society. So there's not a handful of people who are interested in and driven to protecting that monopoly on wealth from other sections of the people. So you could actually bring forward that kind of public security force. You could orient it and train it in the ways that it would have to act to carry that out. And then if people fail to do that, you wouldn't be like, okay, well, we need them to brutalize and murder people, so how are we going to justify and cover over their activity? No, you call it out. You say, yeah, you're right. This is wrong. This should not have happened. And you deal with that where punishment is required. You do that. That's what you would have to do, and that's what you would be able to do, but you need to be outside. You can't do it within the framework of this system. There's a lot of people who are standing up now who are fighting against this and really honestly want to see it stop, but they are locked into the framework of this system. So they are fighting for, you know, people wanted to get body cameras on the police. Okay, well, we're getting body cameras, which means now that if the cops don't turn them off, we get videos of the police brutalizing and murdering people. But even with the videos, the cops are still getting off. People have done this thing they call a campaign zero. And like, here are the 10 reforms that we're going to get that are going to dramatically reduce police murdering people. But as long as you're doing it in the confines of this setup, whether you get a new politician in who declares that they're not going to let this happen, it continues to go on. It's going to take revolution, nothing less, to end it once and for all. And that is not only necessary, but it can be done. And look, I know there are people out there listening who are like, I'm not sure about this revolution thing. Well, dig into it. Go to the website revcom.us. Check out the work of Bob Avakian and get into that. But while you're doing that, we have to stand up and we have to say no more to this. It really is unacceptable and illegitimate. And that's why I was a part of issuing the call for Rise Up October, why I helped form the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, because this needs to be stopped. And everybody who sees it that way needs to stand up and stand together. And people need to be checking. Not only they need to check revcom.us, they also need to be checking the Stop Mass Incarceration Network website, because it's got activities in the offing to step up the resistance to this. There's going to be a series of regional conferences across the country. I know there's going to be at least one, maybe two in California. I don't know the details, but follow that website, stopmassincarceration.net, for that information. No More Stolen Lives Tour is going to be done in different regions of the country, including out on the West Coast. And people need to not only be informed about that and come out to it, but they need to get involved and throw in to make these things happen and bring their ideas for what we need to do around this.
Carl, we got about maybe 8 more minutes. If you can stick around for that long, I want to ask you 2 more questions, which you've hit on some of them, but there's one. You talked about being part of Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and that's the other arm of this genocidal assault against black and brown people in this country. Millions of people in jail. Jail is like very, very much closely related to, in fact, oftentimes, as in Rikers Island, oftentimes the slaughter occurs within the jails, but it's also very linked to the kind of life that people are forced to live, living inside of sort of modern-day Warsaw ghettos or the Nazi ghettos where Jewish people were held and slaughtered and jailed and whatnot. I wanted to ask you this, man. What is it that, like, when you look at, like, what would mass incarceration be like? You're talking about, you said if people screw up, then there's going to be some stuff that people have to do, you know. If they keep doing it, you're going to have to actually deal with that. But what would it be? It wouldn't be like, as far as I understand, there's not going to be giant gulags, right?
No, they're not going to be giant gulags, which is not a declaration that there will be no incarceration of any kind. That's not something we're going to be able to do right after the revolution. But we are going to be able to do a few things. One is we're going to be able to very quickly do a very massive review of those who are incarcerated under this system. Because in addition to the fact that you got people who were framed up and thrown behind the walls of the prisons, as well as people who have been imprisoned for standing up and fighting against this system, there's also a lot of people who ended up in prison because of the discrimination in this society, because of the inequality, put in conditions where it wasn't possible for them to legitimately survive. And we're going to work to get those kind of people out of prison right away. We're going to create situations where people are not going to be driven by the need for money, by the need to be able to support a family, to go out and commit crimes. But we're not Pollyanna about it. We don't think that that's going to mean that crime is going to completely be halted and there'd be no need for prisons. But there would no longer be a thing of a criminal justice system that was set up to target people, to get them into jail. In fact, the role of a prosecutor in this new system, and the Constitution that I referred to earlier gets into this, would be to get at the truth, not to win a conviction. You know, and in this setup, you go into these courts, and I've done this. I've had to do it sometimes as a defendant. Other times, I've just gone in to observe, and you have prosecutors who are clearly shading the truth in order to get a conviction and win. That's not what it should be. There should be a thing of, well, what actually happened? Was there a crime? If so, who committed it? Who's responsible? And what would be the way to combine accountability for that punishment, but also rehabilitation? That's something that the Constitution for a Future Socialist Republic in North America goes into in more depth than I can do it right now, but I did want to speak to that somewhat.
Good. All right, Carl, we got 4 minutes, and this is my last question. The question is, you talked a lot about, and it's even in this week's issue of the paper on RevCom, on RevCom.us, there's the headline of more police murder, more murdering police go free. This cannot go down like this. This cannot go on. You spoke to that a little bit earlier, but I also wanted to ask you the link again, and you referred to this a little bit. I wanted to just get it. We got about 4 minutes, maybe 3 minutes now. The link between people needing to choose the side they're on, standing up and fighting against this, fighting to end this, and what you're saying is the solution, an all-out revolution.
Yeah, I mean, look, people have to view this as, this is a major concern of mine. It's obviously a very major concern to the people who knew and loved these people who've been murdered. But it's a bigger question than that. People cannot stand aside and say, well, that happened to those people over there. This is happening to us, and we have to view it like our children are being murdered. We have to view it like our grandmothers are being shot down. That is how we have to view it. The question that we raised around Rise Up October and that we're going to continue to raise going forward, which side are you on? This is really what's going down in society. You can no longer say you don't know about it because it's being captured on video and posted online. Sometimes it breaks through on TV. You have seen this, and you've also seen the cops get away with this, even when it's as clear as the nose on your face. So you have to stand up and you have to fight around that. And then the other thing that I challenge people to do is to get at this question of, why does this happen? You know, because we could take it back to the days of slavery and look at the way that black people were gone at. We could go to, you know, Jim Crow segregation and lynch mob terror. But this is 2016, and it is still going on today. And it's got to stop. And look, the Revolutionary Communist Party and Bob Avakian, we have developed an understanding for why it is happening. We've talked about the genocidal nature of the attack on black people going down today. We've talked about it being built into the fabric of the system in ways that I talked about earlier, and that it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to end it once and for all, and that that's the way to end all of the horrors that are being brought down. that work has been done and is being done, and it's out there, and people got to dig into that. They can't say, well, I went to the protest of the Tamir Rice verdict the day after. You needed to go there, but you can't say that's enough. I've done my part. Because almost 1,200 people, about 100 people each and every month, that means that since you went to the site last night, the averages say the police have killed somebody else. You know, just in the hours since last night, they'll get 3-4 more today. That's what we're dealing with here. This is unacceptable. It's illegitimate, and it must stop. And it's up to us to stop it. And people have to go as far as their principles will allow them to go in standing up to it. They also have to be digging into why is this happening and what is it going to take to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And if that takes you beyond where your principles are, then you got to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And what there is got to be revolution, nothing less.
Exactly. Carl Dix, thank you very much. And I want to, before you go, I just want to make sure everybody knows this new piece by Bob Avakian. It's called The Science, The Strategy, The Leadership for an Actual Revolution and a Radically New Society on the Road to Real Emancipation. This is a really just a mind-blowing piece by Bob Avakian that is available on revcom.us. All right. So, Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us today. And again, how can people get
thank
in touch
you for
with
having me on.
Sure. How can people get in touch with all this, the things that they need to get in touch with? A couple of addresses real quick.
Two websites, revcom.us and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network website, which is stopmassincarceration.net.
All right, Carl.
Stay on those websites and get involved.
All right, Carl. Thank you very much and talk to you again soon, man. All right. Take care now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we've been talking about basically about the continuing murder, the need for it to stop, and what's the real solution going to be, all right? And how do we actually get involved in all that? How do we actually take up all that? How do we look at that? We're going to listen to a song that came out a number of years ago but is even more pertinent today than it was when it first came out. It's from Gil Scott, and it's Jose Campos Torres. So check this out.
A poem for Jose Campos Torres. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I had confessed to myself all along, tracer of life, poetry, trends, that awareness, consciousness, poems that screamed of pain and the origins of pain and death had blanketed my tablets, and therefore my friends, brothers, sisters, in-laws, outlaws, and besides, they already knew. But Brother Torres, common ancient bloodline Brother Torres, is dead. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I had said I wasn't going to write no more words down about people kicking us when we're down, about racist dogs that attack us and drive us down, drag us down and beat us down. But the dogs are in the street. The dogs are alive and the terror in our hearts has scarcely diminished. It has scarcely brought us the comfort we suspected. The recognition of our terror and the screaming release of that recognition has not removed the certainty of that knowledge. How could it? Dogs, rabid, foaming with the energy of their brutish ignorance, stride the city streets like robot gunslingers and spread death as night lamps flash crude reflections from gun butts and police shields. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. But the battlefield has oozed away from the stilted debates of semantics, beyond the questionable flexibility of primal screaming. The reality of our city, jungle streets and their Gestapos has become an attack on home, life, family, philosophy, total. It is beyond the question of the advantages of didactic niggerisms. The mother dogs are in the street. In Houston, maybe someone said Mexicans were the new niggers. In L.A., maybe someone said Chicanos were the new niggers. In Frisco, maybe someone said Orientals were the new niggers. Maybe in Philadelphia and North Carolina, they decided they didn't need no new niggers. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this, but the dogs are in the street. It's a turnaround world where things are all too quickly turned around. It was turned around so that right looked wrong. It was turned around so that up looked down. It was turned around so that those who marched in the street with Bibles and signs of peace became enemies of the state and risk to national security, so that those who questioned the operations of those in authority on the principles of justice, liberty, and equality became the vanguard of a communist attack. It became so you couldn't call a spade a mother spade. Brother Torres is dead. The Wilmington 10 are still incarcerated. Ed Davis, Ronald Reagan, James Hunt, and Frank Rizzo are still alive, and the dogs are in the mother street. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I made a mistake.
All right. That was a song I really, really wanted to play for quite some time. I've played it before, and I'll probably keep playing it again because, damn it, they keep doing what they do. That was Jose Campos Torres by Gil Scott-Heron. Now we're going to listen to that segment, Why Are We Still Fighting for Justice in 2015? From Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation, and The Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian.
Okay, here's two connected questions that I'm going to ask. One is in reference to the June 4th raid in Harlem. The question is, how do we as a community approach the NYPD and our city officials to demand justice and free our children now, who are now incarcerated? That's right. They're now incarcerated, all facing conspiracy charges and life in prison. We need help. And then, which is a very powerful question, the second is I think, related from someone in Ferguson, Missouri,
Right on.
And they asked, why are we in 2015 still going through this hell? Because I never thought I'd be still fighting for justice. So those two questions.
Yeah, that's a wonderful, wonderful question. Wonderful question. I mean, as I said before, though, that there's a sense in which the struggle for freedom is a perennial struggle because there's progress and then regress. For the last 30 years, there's been a class war against poor and working people, disproportionately targeting young folk of color. And the results of that class war has produced what we're dealing with right now. And that was regress. So we had breakthrough on the one hand, we had regress on the other. The breakthrough was one in which you ended up with the expansion of a black professional class and a black middle class and even a few black top dogs in terms of corporate America and Wall Street, you see. But at the same time, it was a devastation of the black working class and an expansion of the black poor, who more and more find themselves unable to even find a role in the society in terms of jobs, in terms of status, and stature. And that is unbelievable regress. And we're dealing with the consequences of that regress. And so in that sense, you would think, well, my God, 2015, we thought, lo and behold, with Martin King and Fannie Lou Hamer and the others, that we would be able to be closer to black freedom. No, that's not the case at all. That the ruling class in America won the class war over the last 35 years. And we're responding to that triumph from above. And what is wonderful is the degree to which the young folk are willing to fight. And Ferguson is just, I think, the beginning. We're going to see a whole wave of activism among the young folk. And the beautiful thing is that the sisters, the black sisters, will play a fundamental role. Yeah, Tef Poe, that's beautiful, but oh, you got Ashley Yates. Oh, yes, you got Tori Russell, but oh, you got Sister Alexis, and on. It's going to be a collective, mutually gendered and trans affair, which was very different than what it was when we were coming along, because we know how deep that patriarchy was. Isn't that the truth, Joe?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, Lord, indeed. That's why I appreciate your critique of patriarchy, especially for an old school brother like you hitting hard like that. I'm old school, too, but I mean, you'd be surprised.
Well, we have to keep on learning. Right?
Exactly. We got to keep on learning.
Well, I would say, I think these two questions are very much related. I would say the basic answer to the question of why we still have to fight after all this time is because we're still living under the same system. And unless and until we get rid of the system, the same things are going to keep on happening, even if they happen in some different ways. Like I was thinking about Detroit. The most powerful urban rebellion in the 1960s took place in Detroit in 1967. Now, I'm not advocating anything. I'm just telling you the facts. The people rose up in Detroit, and yes, they came in and they killed a lot of them, but they rose up for 5 days. And after they killed them, they said, oh, man, we've got a really serious problem here. And they went and started hiring thousands of black people right off the street into the auto plants of Detroit. And those were high-paying jobs. Now, people always, and again, I'm not advocating anything. I'm just telling you the truth when they always say, oh, when people rise up, it doesn't do any good. It never does anything good. All it does is harm, ruin our own communities. They came and they hired thousands of people right off the street. And then they commissioned the Kerner Commission report. Yeah. You remember saying, oh, we've been mistreating black people. Who knew? And they started talking about how they kind of had to make all these changes.
Absolutely.
But now here's the thing. Here we are almost 50 years later. All those jobs that they hired those thousands of people into are gone. Most of the auto plants are closed down. Detroit is a basket case. I don't care they talk about how they got some kind of resolution to the bankruptcy. It's a basket case. Many people in Detroit can't even get water. Decent water. Think about that. A large number of people. And that's because it's more profitable, like you were just talking about, for them to close down those plants and to open them in some country where they can force the people to work for much lower wages and to replace people by machines. And when they replace people by machines in this system, they don't go to them and say, oh, we're putting you out of a job, but clearly you need to live, so let us train you for another job. They just say, hit the street, you're gone. Because this is the nature of the system. It's a system driven by ruthless competition among capitalists, which drives them to exploit people and to throw them out of work if they can't exploit them enough to make enough profit.
Absolutely.
So what does that prove? Does it prove that it was wrong for people to rise up in Detroit? No. Does it prove that it's wrong for people to be rising up now? Does it do no good to struggle? You might as well just accept it because they'll just beat you down anyway? No. It's very important that people rise up, that they did so then, and I agree with you. We could be on the start of a whole new wave of struggle. But where is it going to go? Are we going to still be facing the same thing 50 years later down the road? Maybe not us, but other people who are coming behind us? Or can we actually get rid of the system and put in place an economic system that is geared to the needs of the people, not the profit of a few, and a political system that goes along with that economic system? So that's one question. Mm-hmm. Now, the other question, and I do think it's very much related, the police went rampaging into these housing projects. This is what they do to our youth all the time. Everybody talks about the prison pipeline from the neighborhood to prison. And this is what they are consciously doing with their mass incarceration, the new Jim Crow that you mentioned, the book by Michelle Alexander. Mm-hmm. This is what they're consciously doing. They put a jacket on these kids from the time they're not even teenagers. And then you've got a record. So now you've got a record. Next time you run into the police, they run you through the system, you got a record. You're already heading toward being a felon, being convicted of a felony, and then being sent to prison. And then your whole family is affected by the fact that you're sent to prison. That's if you survive long enough to be sent to prison. So, you know, these raids they carry out, charging conspiracy, they're going and they're taking the social media of these youth. You know how youth are. You're talking about gangster proclivities, you know. They like to talk big, they like to talk bad, you know. I'm going to do this to you, I'm going to do that to you. They took all that stuff as if it were meant literally and said, this is all, you know, just talking bad on the social media and acted as if this were actually concrete conspiracies that they were waging to go out and kill a bunch of people and sell drugs. I mean, you could take almost any rap song and they do that too. And convict a rapper of conspiracy to commit all kinds of crimes because that's what they often talk about in a rap. So where's your artistic freedom? Where's the freedom for these youth to express? They don't even... Look, you know, I've often thought, sometimes walking down the street, and I have something in my pocket. And I've often thought, as I pull out of my pocket, if I were black, I might be dead now. Because I pulled something out of my pocket that could be construed to look like a gun or some kind of weapon. You don't have, if they've got these youth in the inner cities are under a state of siege where all the rights that we're told we have, they don't have. They don't even have the right to express themselves through social media.
Now,
we cannot accept this. This can't go down. And we've got to go out among not just the people who are directly to answer the question about what do we do about this. We can't just go out among the people who are directly affected by this. We have to go out broadly into society. We have to go out among all the diverse kind of people who are represented here tonight and say, you have to know about what is going on in this country of yours, in this society, where supposedly we have a democracy and supposedly we have rights for the people. But if you live in a certain part of town and you're a certain color and you're looked at by the system in a certain way, you don't have any of even those supposed rights. And we cannot allow that to go on. We've got to, it's our responsibility.
That's right.
It's our party's responsibility. And I'm determined that we live up to our responsibility, but it's also everybody's responsibility to go broadly. We got to go to the students. In the 60s, I was a student in the 60s on the college campus. That's how I got involved in the free speech movement and then working with the Black Panther Party and fighting against the Vietnam War. Why? Because when you get into the, when you're a student, I know a lot of them waste their time on nonsense, but at least when you're a student in college, you have the opportunity to learn about a lot of things if you want to do so and you take some initiative to do so. You have ideas that you can work with. You have the life of the mind that you can pursue if you have a mind to do it. And in the 60s, a lot of students did that. They looked at the world around them. Like I said, they saw people rising up and they said, I want to know what this is about. I want to understand this.
But I think in the 60s, we had something else too. And this is a result of the cultural and spiritual war that went hand in hand with the class war. That when we turned on the radio and heard the voice of a David Ruffin, or when we turned on the radio and heard Sheila and Wanda Hutchison of the Emotions singing, there was a tenderness and a sweetness and a kindness that is the raw stuff of any kind of movement.
Right.
Whereas today, you know, it's say my name, as opposed to try a little tenderness, old as Redden. It's hard to find tenderness, sweetness, and kindness. Same is true in terms of the collectivities. You see, when we turn on the radio, who did we hear? We heard the Delphonics and the Dramatics. We heard Enchantment. You see, we heard Lakeside. We heard Ohio Players. Heaven Must Be Like This and Skin Tight. We heard a tenderness and a sweetness. When they turn on the radio today with the oligarchs and plutocrats, the same ones who control recording and radio and video and live performance. That's exactly right, though, brother. I love that. It's a cultural, spiritual kind of COMINTELPRO. If somehow we can make sure that the precious souls of young Black people, and of course by young Black people, you're talking about all folk, because young people have been Afro-Americanized since Motown, since the Funkadelic, since James Brown. So if we can keep their souls so chilly, and I see this in teaching in prisons for 37 years, I can see the shift in it. To keep the soul so chilly, the conscience so coarsened, and the heart so hardened that you don't have the raw stuff for a movement. People can't wait just to get over, to manipulate and dominate or be obsessed with the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. Because everybody's just trying to get over by any means. That's Wall Street. Not one Wall Street executive went to jail given all the crimes that took place in 2008. They didn't get caught yet. But that sends the same kind of sign in the young folk. But see, but again, when talking about Black people, you got to talk about our spirits and our souls and bodies, as well as the organizing and mobilizing, or we'll never be able to pull it off.
Yeah, well, I agree. I think that,
you see what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I agree. I think that culture is very important. I mean, if you go back to the beginnings of hip-hop and you leave aside sort of silly things like Rapper's Delight or whatever, you know, which had a nice beat, but it wasn't about much.
And a brother just died too, you know.
Yeah.
That brother just died. God bless his soul.
But then you got, you know, Melly Mel.
Grandmaster Flash, The Furious
Grandmaster
Five.
Grandmaster Flash, Melly Mel. Then you got Public Enemy with Chuck D.
KRS-One,
They were talking about something.
Yes.
And what happened? The people who control things in the music industry and in general came in and said, we don't want that.
Right.
Ice-T went from being cop killer to being a cop on TV. And they said, This is the way you want to make it. This is the way you make it. All the rest of that stuff, we're going to push that aside and not let it flourish. So, but I think what's happening now, when you talk about a new wave,
when
you have a new wave of struggle, it brings forward or can bring forward a new culture. And I agree with you. I mean, I grew up on those songs that had tenderness and love, too. You know,
that's
it's very
rich,
different.
Rich stuff.
It's not weak to love. I think that's something very important.
That's exactly right.
It is not weak to love. It is not weak to treat other people as human beings. And we need a culture that grows together with the actual struggle and is a crucial part of the struggle that promotes the kind of values you're talking about, that promotes looking out for each other and being together and seeing what we have in common instead of trying to get over on each other. And I believe, I forget his, I can't call his
Johannes
name right.
Johannes Hernandez. Give it up for Sister Johannes Hernandez, leader of the Mumias Bujamal movement, along with Mark Taylor. We love you, Johannes. We love you, Johannes. Love you, though, sister. I'm sorry to take
it. No, that's all right. No, we got to pay respect.
Yeah, that's true.
I can't call his name, but I know there was a rapper recently who did, after the assassination of Michael Brown, came out with a song about that. I can't remember. There you go. Right? Now, that's just, you know, that's an example of what happens. It wasn't just...
That's right.
Here's the important thing, I think. It wasn't just because yet another black or brown youth was killed in cold blood. It's because people stood up and said, no, we don't care.
Right.
We're not taking this anymore.
That's right.
And that's what inspired a little spark of a new culture. And the more that that happens, the more that we can bring forward that culture. And I agree, we need that culture.
Oh, yeah.
I do agree. I may not agree we need to get it from God, but I agree that we need soul and we need heart.
I agree. I mean, the wonderful thing is that God doesn't ask for your permission. I'm just playing with you, brother.
Well, if I ever hear God asking for my permission, I might change my view.
Oh, Lord. A lot of people see some divine qualities in the love for the masses that you all have in the party. Now you got to watch it.
All right, you just heard Cornell West and Bob Avakian. Why are we still fighting for justice in 2015? From the dialogue entitled Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion. And I want to repeat my earlier reminder. Again, you really do have to go to RevCom.us. Make that one of your New Year's resolutions this year. Go to RevCom.us every day, all right? Because this is the kind of world we live in. We need to know the world in order to be able to change the world. And again, the science, the strategy, the leadership for an actual revolution and a radically new society on the road to real emancipation, a new work by Bob Avakian on RevCom.us. All right, I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. I want to thank my engineer for today, Federico Garcia, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and all of you again for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com, all right? That's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going to go out now with Don't Let Them Get Away with Murder by Jasiri X. Talk to you again next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.